Savannah would have given anything to see, almost anything. How could they be such cowards? How could they let it show? Finally, Modara said, I wonder what would happen if we touched it with fire elsewhere.
Power the call box too much or in the wrong way, and it may melt, a man's voice said out of the air.
It could even ex... The voice cut off as the other women surged to their feet, peering in among the trees.
Alaris and Modara went so far as to draw their belt knives, though they had no need of steel when they had the one power.
Nothing moved among the sun-streaked shadows, not so much as a bird. Savannah did not stir. She had believed perhaps a third of what the wetlander had told her, not including this in truth, but she recognized Kadar's voice. Wetlanders always had more names, but that was all he had given. A man of many secrets, she suspected.
Take your places again, she ordered, and put the flows back where they were. How can I summon him if you fear words?
Riala swung around, mouth gaping and eyes incredulous. Undoubtedly wondering how she knew they had stopped channeling, the woman was not thinking clearly. Slowly, uneasily, they settled in the circle again. Riala donned a flatter face than anyone else.
So you are back, Kadar's voice said from the air. Do you have Althor?
Something in his tone warned her. He could not know, but he did. She abandoned all she had prepared to say.
No, Kadar, but we still must talk. I will meet you in 10 days where we first met.
She could reach that valley in Kinslayer's dagger sooner, but she needed time to prepare. How did he know?
Well, that you told the truth, girl, Kadar murmured dryly. You will learn I do not like being lied to. Maintain the wayline for location, and I will come to you.
Savannah stared at the cube in shock.
Girl? What did you say? She demanded.
Girl? She could not believe her ears. Riala very pointedly did not look at her, and Meera's mouth twisted in a smile, awkward because so seldom used.
Kadar's sigh filled the clearing. Tell your wise one to continue doing exactly what she is doing, nothing else, and I will come to you.
The forced patience in his tone scraped like a grist stone. When she had what she wanted from the wetlander, she would dress him in Guy Shane white. No, in black.
What do you mean you will come, Kadar?
Silence answered.
Kadar, where are you?
Silence.
Kadar?
The others exchanged uneasy glances.
Is he mad? Tion said.
Alaris muttered that he must be, and Belinda angrily demanded to know how long they were to continue this nonsense.
Until I say to stop, Savannah said softly, staring at the cube.
A prickle of hope wormed through her chest. If he could do this, then surely he could deliver what he had promised. And maybe...
She would not hope too much. She looked up through the branches that nearly met above the clearing. The sun still had a way to climb to its peak.
If he has not come by midday, we will go. It was too much to expect they would not grumble.
So we sit here like stones?
Alaris tossed her head in a practiced way, sweeping all of her hair over one shoulder.
For a wetlander?
Whatever he promised you, Savannah, Riala said with a scowl, it cannot be worth this.
He is mad, Tion growled.
Modara nodded toward the cube.
What if he can still hear?
Tion sniffed dismissively, and Somerin said, how should we care if a man hears what we say? But I do not relish waiting for him.
What if he is like those wetlanders in black coats?
Belinda compressed her lips till they nearly matched Mera's.
Do not be ridiculous, Alaris sneered. Wetlanders kill such men on sight. Whatever the Algai de Siswai claim, that must have been the work of the Aes Sedai, and Randall Thor.
That name produced a pained silence, but it did not last.
Kadar must have a cube like this one, Belinda said. He must have a woman with the gift to make it work.
An Aes Sedai? Riala made a noise of disgust in her throat.
If there are 10 Aes Sedai with him, let them come. We will deal with them as they deserve.
Meera laughed, a dry sound as narrow as her face.
I think you almost begin to believe they did kill Dessain.
Watch your tongue, Riala snarled.
Yes, Somerin murmured anxiously. Careless words might be heard by the wrong ears.
Tion's laugh was short and unpleasant.
The lot of you has less courage than one wetlander. Which made Somerin snap back, of course, and Modara, too, and Mera spoke words that would have brought a challenge had they not been wise ones, and Alleri spoke harsher, and Belinda. Their squabbling irritated Savannah, though it guaranteed they would not conspire against her. But that was not why she raised a hand for silence. Riala frowned at her, opening her mouth, and in that moment they heard what she did. Something rustled in the dead leaves among the trees. No Aiel would make so much noise, even if any would approach wise ones unbidden, and no animal would come so near people. This time she rose to her feet with the others. Two shapes appeared, a man and a woman, breaking enough branches underfoot to wake a stone. Just short of the clearing they stopped, and the man bent his head slightly to speak to the woman. It was Kadar, in a nearly black coat with lace at his neck and wrists. At least he did not wear a sword. They seemed to be arguing. Savannah should have been able to hear something of their words, yet the silence was complete. Kadar stood nearly a hand taller than Modara, tall for a wetlander, or even for an Aiel, and the woman's head reached no higher than his chest. As dark of face and hair as he, and beautiful enough to tighten Savannah's mouth, she wore bright red silk, cut to expose even more of her bosom than Somerin showed. As if thinking of the woman called her, Somerin drew close to Savannah. "The woman has the gift," she whispered without taking her eyes from the pair. "She weaves a barrier." Pursing her lips, she added reluctantly, "She is strong, very strong." From her, that meant something indeed. Savannah had never been able to understand why strength and the power did not count among wise ones, while being thankful that it did not, for her own sake. But Somerin prided herself that she had never encountered a woman near as strong as she. By her tone, Savannah suspected this woman was stronger. Right then she did not care whether the woman could move mountains or barely light a candle. She must be Aes Sedai. She did not have the face, yet some Savannah had seen did not. That must be how Kadar could put his hand on Terangreal. That was how he could find them and come. So soon, so quickly. Possibilities unfolded and hope grew. But between him and her, who commanded? "Stop channeling into that," she ordered. "He might still be able to hear through it." Riale gave her a look that did not stop short of pity. Somerin already did, Savannah. Nothing could spoil her mood. She smiled and said, "Very well. Remember what I said. Let me do all of the talking." Most of the others nodded. Riala sniffed. Savannah kept her smile. A wise one could not be made Guy Shane, but so many worn-out customs had been set aside already that others might follow. Kadar and the woman started forward, and Somerin whispered again, "She still holds the power." "Sit next to me," Savannah told her hastily. "Touch my leg if she channels." How that galled, but she must know. She sat, folding her legs under, and the others joined her, leaving a space for Kadar and the woman. Somerin sat close enough that their knees touched. Savannah wished she had a chair. "I see you, Kadar," she said formally, in spite of his insult. "Sit, you and your woman." She wanted to see how the Aes Sedai reacted, but all she did was arch an eyebrow and smile lazily. Her eyes were as black as his, as black as a raven's. The other wise ones let a little coldness show. Had the Aes Sedai at the wells not allowed Randall Thor to break free, they surely would have killed or captured every one. This Aes Sedai must be aware of that, since Kadar plainly knew what had happened, yet she looked anything but afraid. "This is Mysia," Kadar said, lowering himself to the ground, a little short of the space left for him. For some reason he did not like to come within arm's reach. Perhaps he feared knives. "I told you to use a single wise one, Savannah, not six. Some men might be suspicious." For some reason he seemed amused. The woman, Mysia, paused in the act of smoothing her skirts under when he gave her name, glaring at him with a fury that should have stripped his hide away. Perhaps she had thought to keep her identity hidden. She said nothing, though. After a moment she sat beside him, her smile returning so suddenly it might never have gone. Not for the first time Savannah was thankful that wetlanders wore their emotions on their faces. "You have brought the thing that can control Randall Thor?"
She did not even glance at the pitcher of water. When he was so rude, why should she continue the forms? She did not remember him being so when they met before. Perhaps the Aes Sedai emboldened him. Kadar gave her a quizzical look. Why, when you do not have him? I will, she said levelly, and he smiled. So did Mysia. When you do, then? His smile shouted of doubt and disbelief. The woman's mocked. A black robe could be found for her, too. What I have will control him once he is taken, but it cannot overcome him. I won't risk him finding out about me until you have him secure. He did not appear shamed in the slightest by the admission. Savannah forced down a stab of disappointment. One hope gone, but others remained. Riala and Tion folded their hands and stared straight ahead, beyond the circle, beyond him. He was no longer worth listening to. Of course, they did not know everything. What of Aes Sedai? Can this thing control them? Riala and Tion stopped peering beyond the trees. Belinda's eyebrows twitched, and Mera actually looked at her. Savannah could have cursed their lack of self-control. Kadar was as blind as all wetlanders, though. He threw back his head and laughed. Do you mean to say you missed Al-Thor but captured Aes Sedai? You grabbed at the eagle and caught a few larks. Can you provide the same for Aes Sedai? She wanted to grind her teeth. Surely he had been properly courteous before. He shrugged. Perhaps, if the price is right. It was dust to him, of no moment. For that matter, Mysia showed no concern either. Strange, if she was Aes Sedai, but she must be. Your tongue tosses bright colors on the wind, wetlander, Tion said in a flat voice. What proof of them have you? For once, Savannah did not mind that she had spoken out of turn. Kadar's face tightened for all the world as if he were a clan chief, as if he had heard the insult. But in an instant he was all smiles once more. As you wish. Mysia, play with the call box for them. Somerin shifted her skirts, pressing her knuckles against Savannah's thigh as the gray cube rose apace into the air. It bounced back and forth as though tossed from hand to hand, then tilted and spun on one corner like a top, faster and faster until it blurred. Would you like to see it balance on her nose? Kadar asked with a toothy grin. Tight-eyed, the dark woman stared straight ahead, her smile clearly forced now. I think I have demonstrated quite enough, Kadar, she said coldly. But the cube, the call box, continued whirling. Savannah waited a slow count of 20 before saying, That is sufficient. You may stop now, Mysia, Kadar said. Put it back where it was. Only then did the cube slowly descend, nestling gently on its original spot. Dark as she was, the woman looked pale and furious. Had she been alone, Savannah would have laughed and danced. As it was, she had difficulty maintaining a smooth face. Riala and the others were too busy staring disdainfully at Mysia to notice. What worked on one woman with the gift would work on another. No need with Somerin and Modara, perhaps, but Riala and Therava. She could not appear too eager, not when the others knew there were no Aes Sedai captives. Of course, Kadar went on, it will take a little time to provide you with what you wish. He took on a sly look, trying to hide it. Perhaps another wetlander would not have seen. I warn you, the price will not be small. In spite of herself, Savannah leaned forward. And the way you traveled here so quickly? How much to make her teach us that? She managed to keep eagerness from her voice, but she was afraid the contempt she felt came through. Wetlanders would do anything for gold. Perhaps the man heard it. His eyes certainly widened in surprise before he could regain control, such as it was. He studied his hands, and his mouth curled faintly. Why should his smile seem pleased? That is not something she does, he said in a voice as smooth as his palms. Not by herself. It is like the call box. I can provide you with several, but the price of those is even higher. I doubt what you've gleaned from Kyrian will be enough. Fortunately, you can use the traveling boxes to take your people to richer lands. Even Mara was hard-pressed to keep her expression from becoming too avid. Richer lands, and no need to make a way through those fools following Randall Thor.
"Tell me more," Savannah said coolly. "Richer lands might be of some interest."
Not enough to make her forget the Karakarn, though.
Kadar would give her everything he had promised before she declared him Daptsang. As well that he seemed to like wearing black. There would be no need to give him any gold then.
The Watcher ghosted through the trees, making no sound. It was wonderful what you could learn with a call box, especially in a world where there seemed to be only two others. That red dress was easy to follow, and they never looked back even to see whether some of those so-called Aiel were trailing them. Grendel maintained the mask of mirrors that hid her true form, but Samael had dropped his, golden-bearded again, and just head and shoulders taller than she. He had let the link between them dissolve, too. The Watcher wondered whether that was wise, under the circumstances. He had always wondered how much of Samael's vaunted bravery was really stupidity and blindness. But the man did hold Saidin. Perhaps he was not completely unaware of his danger. The Watcher followed and listened. They had no idea. The true power, drawn directly from the Great Lord, could neither be seen nor detected except by who wielded it. Black flecks floated across his vision. There was a price, to be sure, one that grew with each use, but he had always been willing to pay the price when it was necessary. Being filled with the true power was almost like kneeling beneath Shael Ghul, basking in the Great Lord's glory. The glory was worth the pain. "Of course I've had to have you with me," Samael growled, stumbling over a dead vine. He had never really been at home away from the cities. "You answered 100 questions for them just being there. I can hardly believe that silly girl herself actually suggested what I wanted." He barked a laugh. "Perhaps I'm Tavirin myself." A branch that partially blocked Grendel's path flexed away until it snapped with a sharp crack. For a moment it hung in the air as if she intended to strike her companion.
"That silly girl will cut out your heart and eat it, given half a chance."
The branch flew aside.
"I have a few questions of my own. I never thought you would keep your truce with Althor any longer than you must, but this..."
The Watcher's eyebrows rose. A truce? A claim as risky as it was false, by all evidence. "I didn't arrange his kidnapping." Samael gave her what he probably thought was a wry look. His scar made it more a snarl. "Messana had a hand in it, though. Maybe Dimondred and Simarag as well, despite how it ended. But Nasana, certainly. Perhaps you ought to reconsider what you think the Great Lord means about leaving Althor unharmed." Grendel considered that, so much so that she tripped. Samael caught her by the arm, keeping her on her feet, but as soon as she regained her balance, she jerked free. Interesting, even given what had happened back in that clearing. Grendel's real interest was always the most beautiful, plucked from among the most powerful. But she would have flirted, just to pass an hour, with a man she intended to kill, or one who wanted to kill her. The only men she never flirted with were those of the Chosen who stood above her for a time. She never accepted being the lesser of any pair.
"Then why continue with them?"
Her voice dripped molten lava, although normally she had exquisite control over her emotions.
"Althor in Messana's hands is one thing. Althor in this savage's is something else. Not that you'll have much chance at him if you really intend sending them off to loot. Traveling boxes? What is your game there? Do they hold captives? If you think I will teach them compulsion, erase it from your mind. One of those women was not negligible. I will not risk strength and skill residing together in her, or in someone she teaches. Or do you have a binder hidden away with your other toys? For that matter, where were you earlier? I do not like having to wait."
Samael stopped, glancing behind them. The Watcher stood very still. Swathed in fan-cloth, except for his eyes, he had no worry that he would be seen. Over the years he had learned expertise in many areas Samael scorned. In some he favored, too. The gateway opening suddenly, slicing away half of a tree, made Grendel jump. The split trunk leaned drunkenly. Now she also knew Samael held to the source. "Do you think I was telling them the truth?" Samael said mockingly. "Small increases in chaos are as important as large. They will go where I send them, do as I wish, and learn to be satisfied with what I give them. As will you, Maesia." Grendel let her illusion fade and stood golden-haired as he, as fair as she had been dark. "If you call me that again, I will kill you." Her voice held even less expression than her face. She meant it. The watcher tensed. If she tried, one of the two would die. Should he interfere? Black flecks sped across his eyes. Faster, faster. Samael met her stare with one just as hard. "Remember who will be nameless, Grendel," he said, and stepped through his gateway. For a moment she stood looking at the opening. A vertical silver slash appeared off to one side, but before her gateway began to align, she let go the weave, slowly, the streak shrinking to a point before winking out. The prickling vanished from the watcher's skin as she released Sayadar as well. With a fixed face she followed Samael, and his gateway closed behind her. The watcher smiled crookedly behind his fan-cloth skulker's mask. Nameless. That explained what had brought Grendel to heel, what had stayed her from killing Samael. Even she would be blinded by that. An even greater risk for Samael than claiming truce with Luz Theron, though. Unless, of course, it was true. The Great Lord delighted in setting his servants one against another, to see who was stronger. Only the strongest could stand near his glory. But today's truth need not be tomorrow's. The Watcher had seen truth change 100 times between a single sunrise and sunset. More than once he had changed it himself. He considered going back and killing the 7 women in the clearing. They would die easily. He doubted they knew how to form a true circle. The black flecks filled his eyes, a horizontal blizzard. No. He would let that run its course. For now. To his ears, the world screamed as he used the true power to rip a small hole and step outside the pattern. Samael did not know how truly he spoke. Small increases in chaos could be every bit as important as large. Chapter 21 Swovan Night. Night came slowly over Ebudar, the glow of the white buildings resisting darkness. Small knots and bunches of Swovan Night revelers, with little sprigs of evergreen in their hair, danced in the streets beneath a bright three-quarter moon, few carrying so much as a lantern as they gambled to the music of flutes and drums and horns that drifted from inns and palaces, dancing their way from one set of festivities to another. But for the most part, the streets lay empty. A distant dog barked, and another, closer, answered furiously until it suddenly yelped and fell silent. Balanced on his toes, Matt listened, eyes searching the moon shadows. Only a cat moved, slinking along the street. The slap of running bare feet faded. The owner of one pair should be staggering, and the other bleeding. As he bent, his foot kicked a club as long as his arm on the paving stones. Heavy brass studs shone in the moonlight. That would have broken his skull for sure. Shaking his head, he wiped his knife on the ragged coat worn by the man at his feet. Open eyes stared at the night sky from a dirty, creased face. A beggar, by the look and smell of him. Matt had not heard of beggars attacking people. But maybe times were harder than he thought. A large jute sack lay near one outstretched hand. The fellows certainly had been optimistic about what they would find in his pockets. The thing could have covered him from head to knees. To the north, above the city, light suddenly burst in the sky with a hollow boom, as glittering streaks of green expanded in a ball, and then another eruption showered red sparkles through the first, then a blue and a yellow. Illuminator's night flowers, not as spectacular as they would have been in a moonless, cloudy sky, yet still they took his breath. He could watch fireworks till he fell over from hunger. Nalesian had spoken of an illuminator. Light, was that only this morning? But no more night flowers came. When illuminators made the sky bloom, as they said, they planted more than four flowers. Plainly someone with coin had made a purchase for Swovan night. He wished he knew who. An illuminator who would sell night flowers would sell more than that. Slipping the knife back up his sleeve, he gathered his hat from the pavement and walked away hurriedly, his boots echoing, a sound empty as the street. Most shuttered windows here showed not a glimmer of light. A better place for murder probably could not be found in the city. The entire encounter with the three beggars had lasted only a minute or two, and had been seen by no one. In this city you could find three or four fights in a day if you were not careful, but the odds of facing two sets of robbers in one day seemed about as great as the odds of the civil guard refusing a bribe. What was happening to his luck? If only those bloody dice would stop rolling in his head. He did not run, but he did not dawdle either, one hand on a hilt beneath his coat and an eye open for anyone moving in the shadows. He saw nothing but a few clumps of people cavorting along the street, though. In the common room of the Wandering Woman, the tables had been cleared away except for a few near the walls. The flutists and the drummer made shrill music for four laughing lines of people doing what appeared to be half-pattern dance and half-jig. Watching, he copied a step. Outland merchants in fine woolens leaped right along with locals in brocaded silk vests or those useless coats slung on their shoulders. He marked out two of the merchants for the way they moved, one slender and one not, yet both with a light grace, and several local women wearing their best, the deep necklines outlined by a little lace or a great deal of embroidery, but none in silk. Not that he would refuse to dance with a woman in silk, of course. He had never turned down a dance with any woman of any age or station. But the rich were in the palaces tonight, or the homes of the wealthier merchants and moneylenders. Those folk near the walls, catching their breath for the next dance, had their faces buried in mugs as often as not, and were snatching fresh mugs from trays carried by scurrying serving women. Mistress Annan would likely sell as much wine tonight as in an ordinary week. Ale, too. The local folk must have no taste to their tongues. Trying another step of the dance, he caught Kyra as she tried to hurry by with a tray, pitching his voice loud above the music to ask a few questions, and finishing with an order for his dinner. Gilded fish, a tangy dish that Mistress Annan's cook prepared to perfection. A man needed his strength to keep up in the dance. Kyra flashed a sultry smile at a fellow in a yellow vest who grabbed a mug from her tray and dropped his coin on it, but for once she had no smile for Matt. In fact, she managed to compress her mouth to a thin line, no small feat.
"Your little rabbit, am I?"
With a telling sniff, she went on impatiently.
"The boy is tucked into his bed where he should be, and I don't know where Lord Nalesian is, or Harnan, or Master Vannon, or anybody else. And cook says she won't fix anything but soup and bread for those as are drowning their tongues in wine. Though why my lord wants gilded fish when he has a gilded woman waiting in his room, I'm sure I couldn't say. If my lord will excuse me, some people need to work for their crust."
She swooped away, proffering her tray, and smiling fit to split her face at every man in sight. Matt frowned after her. A gilded woman? In his room? The chest of gold rested now in a small hollow beneath the kitchen floor, in front of one of the stoves, but the dice in his head drummed like thunder suddenly. The sounds of merriment faded a little as he slowly climbed the stairs. In front of his door he paused, listening to the dice. Two attempts to rob him so far today. Twice his skull could have been broken. He was sure that Dark Friend had not seen him, and no one could call her gilded, but... He fingered a hilt under his coat, then took his hand away as a woman flared into his thoughts, a tall woman, falling with the hilt of a knife protruding between her breasts. His knife. Luck would just have to be with him. Sighing, he pushed open the door. The hunter that Elaine had made her warder turned, hefting his unstrung Two Rivers bow, her golden braid drawn over her shoulder. Her blue eyes fastened on him purposefully, and her face fixed itself in determination. She looked ready to drub him with the bow if she did not get what she wanted. "If this is about Oliver," he began, and suddenly a twist of memory unfolded. A mist thinned over one day, one hour in his life. There was no hope. With Sean Chan to the west and White Cloaks to the east, no hope and only one chance. So he raised the curled horn and blew, not really knowing what to expect. The sound came golden as the horn, so sweet he did not know whether to laugh or cry. It echoed, and the earth and heavens seemed to sing. While that one pure note hung in the air, a fog began to rise, appearing from nowhere, thin wisps thickening, billowing higher, until all was obscured as if clouds covered the land. And down the clouds they rode, as though down a mountainside, the dead heroes of legend, bound to be called back by the Horn of Valir. Arthur Hawkwing himself led, tall and hook-nosed, and behind came the rest, little more than 100. So few. But all those the wheel would spin out again and again to guide the pattern, to make legend and myth. Michael of the Pure Heart, and Siobhan the Hunter, behind his black mask. He was said to herald the end of ages, the destruction of what had been, and the birth of what was to be. He and his sister Callion, called the Chooser, who rode red-masked at his side. Amarisu, with the Sword of the Sun glowing in her hands, and Pedrig, the golden-tongued peacemaker. And there, carrying the silver bow with which she never missed. He pushed the door shut, trying to lean against it. He felt dizzy, dazed. "You are she. Birgitta, for true. Burn my bones to ash, it's impossible. How? How?" The woman of legend gave a resigned sigh and propped his bow back in the corner next to his spear. "I was ripped out untimely, Hornsounder, cast out by Mogedion to die, and saved by Elaine's bonding." She spoke slowly, studying him as to be sure he understood. "I feared you might remember who I used to be." Still feeling hit between the eyes, he flung himself scowling into the armchair beside his table. Who she used to be, indeed. Fists on hips, she confronted him challengingly, no whit different from the Brigitte he had seen right out of the sky. Even her clothes were the same, though this short coat was red and the wide trousers yellow. "Elaine and Nynaeve know and kept it from me, true?" "I weary of secrets, Brigitte, and they harbor secrets as a grain barn harbors rats. They've become Aes Sedai, eyes and hearts. Even Nynaeve is twice a stranger now." "You have your own secrets." Folding her arms under her breasts, she sat on the foot of his bed. The way she looked at him, you would have thought he was a tavern puzzle. "For one, you've not told them you blew the Horn of Valir. The smallest of your secrets from them, I think." Matt blinked. He had assumed they had told her. After all, she was Brigitte. "What secrets do I have? Those women know my toenails and dreams." She was Brigitte. "Of course." He leaned forward. "Make them see reason. You're Brigitte Silverbow. You can make them do as you say. This city has a pit trap at every crossing, and I fear the stakes grow sharper by the day. Make them come away before it's too late." She laughed, put a hand over her mouth, and laughed. "You have the wrong end, Hornsounder. I do not command them. I am Elaine's warder. I obey. Her smile became rueful. Birgitta Silverbow. Faith of the light, I'm not sure I still am that woman. So much of what I was and knew has faded like mist beneath the summer sun since my strange new birth. I'm no hero now, only another woman to make my way. And as for your secrets, what language do we speak, Horn Sounder? He opened his mouth and stopped, really hearing what she had just asked. Nosana Irogavana de Murakashi, Denend Mapravena. Speak we what language, Sounder of the Horn? The hair on his neck tried to stand. The old tongue, he said carefully. Not in the old tongue. An Aes Sedai once told me the old blood runs strong in... What are you bloody well laughing at now?
You, Matt,
she managed while trying not to double over. At least she was not speaking the old tongue anymore either. She knuckled a tear from the corner of her eye.
Some people speak a few words, a phrase or two, because of the old blood. Usually without understanding what they say, or not quite. But you... One sentence you're an Eheroni High Prince, and the next a First Lord of Manetherin, accent and idiom perfect. No, don't worry, your secret is safe with me.
She hesitated. Is mine with you? He waved a hand, still too flabbergasted to be offended. Do I look like my tongue flaps? He muttered.
Birgitta, in the flesh.
Burn me, I could use a drink.
Before that was out of his mouth, he knew it was the wrong thing to say. Women never...
That sounds the right notion to me, she said. I could use a pitcher of wine myself. Blood and ashes, when I saw you'd recognized me, I nearly swallowed my tongue.
He sat up straight, as if he had been jerked, staring. She met his gaze with a merry twinkle and a grin.
There's enough noise in the common room. We could overtalk without being overheard. Besides, I wouldn't mind sitting and looking a bit. Elaine preaches like a Tovan counselor if I ogle a man for longer than a heartbeat.
He nodded before he thought. Other men's memories told him Tovans were a stark and disapproving people, abstemious to the point of pain. At least they had been, 1,000 years gone and more. He was not sure whether to laugh or groan. On the one hand, a chance to talk with Birgitta.
Birgitta!
He doubted he would ever get over the shock. But on the other, he doubted he would be able to hear the music downstairs for the noise of those dice rattling in his skull. She must be a key to it somehow. A man with any brains would climb out the window right now.
A pitcher or two sounds fine to me, he told her.
A stiff salt breeze up from the bay carried a touch of coolness for a wonder, but the night felt oppressive to Nynaeve. Music and snatches of laughter drifted into the palace, and faintly from within as well. She had been invited to the ball by Tylin herself, and Elaine and Avienda too, but all declined with varying degrees of politeness. Avienda had said there was only one dance she was willing to do with Wetlander men, which made Tylin blink uncertainly. For herself, Nynaeve would have liked to go. Only a fool passed up any chance to dance. Yet she knew if she had, she would have done exactly what she was doing, sat somewhere worrying and trying not to chew her knuckle to a nub. So there they all were, closeted in their apartments with Tom and Julin, anxious as caged cats, while everyone else in Ebu Dar made merry. Well, she was, anyway. What could be keeping Birgitta? How long did it take to tell a man to present himself first thing in the morning? Light. The whole effort was useless, and it was long past time for bed. Long past. If she could only sleep, she could put away memories of the morning's horrible journeys by boat. Worst of all, her weather sense told her a storm was on the way. Told her the wind should be howling outside, and the rain sheeting down so thick no one could see 10 feet. It had taken her some time to understand about the times she listened to the wind, and seemed to hear lies. At least she thought she understood. Another kind of storm was coming, not wind or rain. She had no proof, but she would eat her slippers if Matt Cawthon was not part of it somehow. She wanted to sleep for a month, a year, to forget worries until Lan wakened her with a kiss, like the Sun King with Talia. Which was ridiculous, of course. That was only a story, and a very improper one at that. And anyway, she was not about to become any man's pet, not even Lan's. She would find him, though, somehow, and bond him hers. She would... light. If she had not thought the others would stare at her, she would have paced the soles out of her slippers. The hours wore on. She read and reread the short letter Matt had left with Tylan. Avienda sat quietly beside her high-backed chair, cross-legged on the pale green floor tiles as usual, an ornately gilded leather-bound copy of The Travels of Jane Farstrider open on her knees. No anxiety there, not to see. But then the woman would not turn a hair if someone stuffed a viper down her dress. Since returning to the palace, she had donned the intricate silver necklace she wore nearly day and night. Except on the boat trip, she had said she did not want to risk it then. Idly, Nynaeve wondered why she no longer wore her ivory bracelet. There had been an overheard conversation, something about not wearing it until Elaine had its like, which made little sense, and mattered as little as the bracelet, of course. The letter called from her lap. The sitting room stand lamps made reading easy, though Matt's unformed, boyish hand did present difficulties. It was the contents that clenched Nynaeve's middle into knots. "There's nothing here but heat and flies, and we can find plenty of those in Camelin." "Are you sure you didn't tell him anything?" she demanded. Across the room, Julin paused with his hand over the stones board, giving her a look of outraged innocence. "How often must I say so?" Outraged innocence was one of the things men did best, especially when they were guilty as foxes in the henyard. Interesting that the carving around the board's rim was of foxes. Tom, seated across the lapis-inlaid table from the thief-catcher, looked as little the gleeman in his finely cut coat of bronze wool as he did the man who had once been Queen Morgaze's lover. Gnarled and white-haired, with long moustaches and thick eyebrows, he was frustrated patience from his sharp blue eyes to his boot-soles. "I can't see how we could have, Nynaeve," he said dryly, "given that you told us next to nothing until tonight. You should have sent Julin and me." Nynaeve sniffed loudly. As if those two had not been running around like chickens with their heads off ever since they arrived, prying into her and Elaine's affairs on Matt's say-so. Those three could not be together 2 minutes without gossiping either. Men never could. The truth of it was, she admitted reluctantly, using the men had never occurred to them. "You'd have gone off carousing and drinking with him," she muttered. "Don't tell me you would not." That must be where Matt was, leaving Birgitta to cool her feet at the inn. That man would find some way to set the whole scheme awry. And what if they had? Leaning beside one of the tall, arched windows, peering out at the night through the white-painted iron balcony, Elaine giggled. She was tapping her foot, though how she could make out one tune from all those floating in the darkness was a wonder. "It is a night for... carousing." Nynaeve frowned at her back. Elaine had been increasingly peculiar all night. If she had not known better, she would have suspected the other woman had been sneaking out to snatch sips of wine. Gulps of it, actually. Even if Elaine had not been under her eye, though, that was impossible. Each of them had had a rather unfortunate experience with too much wine, and neither had again let herself have more than a single cup at a time. "It is Jakim Karadin who interests me," Avienda said, closing the book and setting it beside her. She refused to consider how odd she looked, sitting on the floor in a blue silk dress. "Among us, shadow runners are killed as soon as found, and not clan, sept, society, or First Sister will raise a hand in protest. If Jakim Karadin is a shadow runner, why does Tylan Mitzobar not kill him? Why do we not?" "Matters are a little more complex here," Nynaeve told her, though she had wondered the same. Not why Karadin was not killed, of course, but why he was still allowed to come and go as he wished. She had seen him in the palace that very day, after she had been handed Matt's letter, after she had told Tylan what it contained. He had spoken with Tylan above an hour and departed with as much honor as when he arrived. She had meant to discuss it with Elaine, but the question of what Matt knew and how kept intruding. That man would make trouble. He would, somehow. This business was going to go wrong no matter what anyone said. Bad weather was coming. Tom cleared his throat. Tylin is a weak queen, and Caradine the ambassador of a power. Placing a stone, he kept his eyes on the board. He sounded as though he was thinking aloud. By definition, a white-cloak inquisitor cannot be a dark friend. At least, that's how it is defined in the Fortress of the Light. If she arrests him, or even charges him, she'll find a white-cloak legion in Ebudar before she can blink. They might leave her the throne, but she'd be a puppet from then on, strings pulled from the Dome of Truth. Aren't you ready to concede yet, Julin? The thief-catcher glared at him, then bent to a furious study of the board. "I did not think her a coward," Avienda said disgustedly, and Tom gave her an amused smile. "You have never faced something you could not fight, child," he said gently. "Something so strong your only choice is to flee or be consumed alive. Try to hold judgment on Tylin till you have." For some reason Avienda's face reddened. Normally she hid her emotions so well her face was like stone. "I know," Elaine said suddenly. "We'll find proof even Pedro Nile must accept." She skipped back into the room. No, she danced. "We will disguise ourselves and follow him." Suddenly it was no longer Elaine standing there in a green Ebudari gown, but a Domani woman in thin, clinging blue. Nynaeve leaped up before she could stop, and her mouth tightened with exasperation at herself. Just because she could not see the weaves at the moment was no reason to be startled by illusion. She darted a glance at Tom and Julin. Even Tom's mouth hung open. Unconsciously, she took a firm grip on her braid. Elaine was going to reveal everything. What was the matter with her? Illusion worked best the closer you stayed to what was there before, in shape and size at least, so bits of the Ebudari dress flashed through the Domani garment as Elaine whirled to examine herself in one of the room's two large mirrors. She laughed and clapped her hands. "Oh, he will never recognize me. Or you, near sister." Abruptly, a Taraboner woman sat beside Nynaeve's chair, with brown eyes and yellow braids strung with red beads just the shade of her snug-fitting dress of folded silk. She watched Elaine quizzically. Nynaeve's hand tightened on her braid. "And we can't forget you," Elaine babbled on. "I know just the thing." This time Nynaeve saw the glow around Elaine. She was furious. Seeing the flows being woven about herself did not tell her what image Elaine gave her, of course. It took looking into one of the mirrors to do that. A seafolk woman stared back at her, aghast, with a dozen begemmed rings in her ears and twice as many golden medallions dangling from the chain running to her nose ring. Aside from the jewelry, she wore wide trousers of brocaded green silk, and not a stitch else, the way women of the Athaan Mier did out of sight of land. It was just illusion. She was still decently clothed under the weaving. But beside her reflection, she saw those of Tom and Julin, both fighting grins. A strangled squawk erupted from her throat. "Close your eyes!" she shouted at the men, and began leaping about, waving her arms, anything to make her dress show through. "Close them, burn you!" Oh, they had. Bristling with indignation, she stopped capering. They were not fighting those grins any more, though. For that matter, Avienda was laughing quite openly, rocking to and fro. Nynaeve gave her skirts a jerk. In the mirror, the seafolk woman seemed to pluck at her trousers and fixed Elaine with a glare. "Stop this, Elaine!" The Domani woman stared back, mouth open and eyes wide with incredulity. Only then did Nynaeve realize how angry she was. The true source beckoned from just beyond the edge of sight. Embracing Sidar, she slammed a shield between Elaine and the source. Or rather, she tried to. Shielding someone who already held the power was not easy, even when you were the stronger. Once, as a girl, she had swung Master Luhan's hammer against his anvil as hard as she could, and the shiver of it ran all the way to her toes. This was about twice that. "Love of the light, Elaine, are you drunk?" The glow around the Damani woman faded away, and so did the Damani woman. Nynaeve knew the weave was gone from around herself, but she still glanced at the mirror and drew a relieved breath to see Nynaeve Almiera there in yellow-slashed-blue. "No," Elaine said slowly. Color burned in her face, but it was not embarrassment, or not entirely. Her chin rose and her voice frosted. "I am not." The door to the corridor banged open, and Brigitta staggered in with a broad smile. Well, perhaps she did not quite stagger, but she was decidedly unsteady. "I did not expect you all to remain awake for me," she said brightly. "Well, you'll be interested to hear what I have to say. But first..." With the two steady steps of someone carrying considerable drink inside, she vanished into her room. Tom stared at her door with a bemused grin, Julin with an incredulous one. They knew who she was, the truth of it. Elaine just glared down her nose. From Birgitta's bedchamber came a splashing, as if a pitcher had been upended on the floor. Nynaeve exchanged puzzled looks with Avienda. Brigitta reappeared with her face and hair dripping and her coat soaked from shoulders to elbows. "Now my wits are clearer," she said, settling into one of the ball-footed chairs with a sigh. "That young man has a hollow leg and a hole in the bottom of his foot. He even outdrank Beslin, and I was beginning to think wine was water to that lad." "Beslin?" Nynaeve said, her voice rising. "Tylin's son? What was he doing there?" "Why did you allow it, Brigitta?" Elaine exclaimed. "Matt Coffin will corrupt the boy, and his mother will blame us." "The boy's the same age as you," Tom told her in stuffy tones. A baffled look passed between Nynaeve and Elaine. What was his point? Everyone knew that a man did not achieve his proper wits, such as they were, until 10 years later than a woman. The puzzlement faded from Elaine's face, replaced by firmness and no little anger as she focused on Brigitta again. Words were going to be said, words both women might regret tomorrow. "If you and Julin will leave us now, Tom," Nynaeve said quickly. It was extremely unlikely they would see the need on their own. "You need your sleep to be fresh first thing in the morning." They sat there, gaping at her like belled fools, so she made her tone firmer. "Now?" "The game was done 20 stones ago," Tom said, glancing at the board. "What do you say we go down to our own room and start another? I'll spot you 10 stones to place as you will any time during the game."
10 stones?
Julin yelped, scraping back his chair. "Will you offer me fish broth and milk bread as well?" They argued all the way out, but at the door each of them glanced back in sullen resentment. She would not put it past them to remain awake all night, just because she had sent them to bed. "Matt won't corrupt Beslin," Birgitta said dryly as the door closed behind the men. "I doubt 9 feathered dancers with a shipload of brandy could corrupt him. They wouldn't know where to begin." Nynaeve was relieved to hear it, though something was odd about the woman's tone, likely the drink. But Beslin was not at all the issue. She said so, and Elaine added, "No, he isn't. You got drunk, Brigitta, and I felt it. I still feel tipsy if I don't concentrate. The bond is not supposed to work that way. Aes Sedai don't fall over giggling if their warders drink too much." Nynaeve threw up her hands. "Don't look at me that way," Brigitta said. "You know more than I do. Aes Sedai and warders have always been men and women before. Maybe that's the difference. Maybe we're two alike." Her grin was skewed slightly. There had not been near enough water in that pitcher. "That might be embarrassing, I suppose."
"If we could stay with what is important," Nynaeve said tightly, "such as Matt."
Elaine had her mouth open for a retort to Brigitta, but she closed it quickly.
the red spots in her cheeks most definitely chagrin this time. "Now," Nynaeve went on, "will Matt be here in the morning, or is he in the same revolting state as you?"
"He might come," Birgitta said, taking a cup of mint tea from Avienda, who of course sat down on the floor. Elaine frowned at her a moment, then of all things folded up her legs and sat beside her.
"What do you mean, he might?" Nynaeve demanded. She channeled, and the chair she had been sitting in floated over to her, and if it banged to the floor, she meant it to. Drinking too much, sitting on the floor. What was next?
"If he expects us to come to him on hands and knees..."
Birgitta took a sip of the tea with a grateful murmur, and oddly, when she looked at Nynaeve again, she did not seem so intoxicated.
"I talked him out of that. I don't think he was really serious. All he wants now is an apology and thanks."
Nynaeve's eyes popped. She had talked him out of that? Apologize? To Matrim Cawthon? Never! She growled.
"For what?"
Elaine wanted to know, as if that mattered. She pretended not to see Nynaeve's glare.
"The Stone of Tyr," Birgitta said, and Nynaeve's head whipped around. The woman no longer sounded intoxicated at all.
"He says he went into the stone, him and Julin, to free the pair of you from a dungeon you couldn't escape on your own."
She shook her head slowly, in wonder. "I don't know that I would have done that for anyone short of Gaidol. Not the stone.
He says you gave him a backhanded thanks and made him feel he ought to be grateful you didn't kick him."
It was true, in a way. But all distorted. There Matt had been with that mocking grin of his, saying he was there to pull their chestnuts off the fire or some such. Even then he had thought he could tell them what to do.
"Only one of the Black Sisters was on guard in the dungeon," Nynaeve muttered, "and we had taken care of her."
True, they hadn't yet been able to figure out how to open the door, shielded.
"Balal wasn't really interested in us anyway. It was just to lure Rand. Warain may already have killed him by then, for all we know."
"The Black Aja." Birgitta's voice was flatter than the floor tiles.
"And one of the Forsaken. Matt never mentioned them. You owe him thanks on your knees, Elaine. Both of you do. The man deserves it. And Julin as well."
Blood rushed to Nynaeve's face. He had never mentioned? That despicable, despicable man!
"I will not apologize to Matrim Cawthon, not on my deathbed!"
Avienda leaned toward Elaine, touching her knee.
"Near sister, I will say this delicately." She looked and sounded about as delicate as a stone post. "If this is true, you have toe toward Matt Cawthon, you and Nynaeve, and you have made it worse since, just by the actions I have seen."
"Toe!" Nynaeve exclaimed. "Those two were always talking about this toe foolery.
We aren't Aiel, Avienda, and Matt Cawthon is a thorn in the foot to everybody he meets."
But Elaine was nodding.
"I see. You are right, Avienda. But what must we do?
You will have to help me, near sister. I don't intend to try to become Aiel, but I want you to be proud of me."
"We will not apologize," Nynaeve snapped.
"I have pride in knowing you," Avienda said, touching Elaine's cheek lightly. "An apology is a beginning, yet not enough to meet toe now."
"Are you listening to me?" Nynaeve demanded. "I said I will not apologize."
They went right on talking. Only Birgitta looked at her, and the woman wore a smile not far from outright laughter. Nynaeve throttled her braid with both hands. She had known that they should have sent Tom and Jewel in.
Chapter 22 Small Sacrifices. Squinting up at the sign above the inn's arched door, a crudely drawn woman with a walking staff peering hopefully into the distance, Elaine wished she were back in her bed instead of up with the sun. Not that she could have slept. Molhara Square stood empty behind her except for a few creaking ox and donkey carts on their way to the markets, a scattering of women balancing huge baskets on their heads. A one-legged beggar sat with his bowl at a corner of the inn, the first of many who would dot the square later. She had already given him a silver mark, enough to feed him for a week even now, but he tucked it under his ragged coat with a toothless grin and waited on. The sky was still gray, yet the day already promised to scorch. Keeping concentration well enough to ignore the heat was a problem this morning. The last remnants of Birgitta's morning-after head remained in the back of her own, dwindling but not yet gone. If only her small ability with healing had not proved too small. She hoped Avienda and Birgitta would manage to learn something useful about Caradin this morning, in their illusion disguises. Not that Caradin would know any of them from a shoemaker, of course, but it was best to be careful. She felt pride that Avienda had not asked to come along here, had in fact been surprised at the suggestion. Avienda did not believe she needed anyone to watch her, to make sure she did what was needful. With a sigh, she straightened her dress, though there was no need. Blue and cream with a bit of cream-colored Vandalra lace, the garment did make her feel just a touch exposed. The only time she had balked at donning a local fashion was while she and Nynaeve traveled to Tanchica with the sea folk. But in its own way, Ebudari fashion was almost... She sighed again. She was just trying to delay. Avienda should have to come to lead her by the hand. "I will not apologize," Nynaeve said suddenly at her shoulder. She clutched her own gray skirts with both hands, staring at the wandering woman as though Mogedion herself waited inside. "I won't."
"You should have worn white, after all,"
Elaine murmured, earning a suspicious sideways glance. After a moment she added, "You did say it was the color for funerals," which produced a satisfied nod, though it was not what she had meant at all. This would be a disaster if they could not keep peace among themselves. Birgitta had had to settle for an infusion of herbs this morning, and a particularly bitter mix at that, because Nynaeve claimed she was not angry enough to channel. She had gone on in the most dramatic manner about funeral white being the only suitable color, insisted she was not coming, until Elaine dragged her out of their apartments and announced at least 20 times since that she would not apologize. Peace had to be kept, but... "You agreed to this, Nynaeve. No, I don't want to hear any more about the rest of us bullying you. You agreed. So stop sulking." Nynaeve spluttered, eyes going wide with outrage. She was not to be diverted, though, despite one fiercely incredulous "sulking" under her breath. "We need to discuss this further, Elaine. There is no need to be so hasty. There must be 1,000 reasons why this won't work, Taviran or no Taviran, and Matt Cawthon is 900 of them." Elaine gave her a level look. "Did you deliberately choose the bitterest herbs that would work this morning?" Wide-eyed outrage turned to wide-eyed innocence, but red stained Nynaeve's cheeks. Elaine pushed open the door. Nynaeve followed, muttering. Elaine would not have been surprised if she stuck out her tongue, too. Sulky was not even in it this morning. The smell of breads baking wafted from the kitchens, and all the shutters were open to air out the common room. A plump-cheeked serving-woman standing atop a tall stool stretched on tiptoes to take down bedraggled evergreen branches from above the windows, while others replaced tables and benches and chairs that must have been taken away for the dancing. This early no one else was about, except for a skinny girl in a white apron, sweeping half-heartedly with a brush-broom. She might have been pretty if her mouth had not seemed set in a constant pout. There was surprisingly little mess, considering that inns were supposed to be riotous, even licentious, during festivals. A part of her wished she could have seen it, though. "Could you direct me to Master Cawthon's rooms?" she asked the skinny girl with a smile, proffering 2 silver pennies. Nynaeve sniffed. She was tight as the skin on a fresh apple. She had given the beggar 1 copper. The girl eyed them sullenly, and surprisingly the coins as well, and mumbled something sour that sounded like, "A gilded woman last night and ladies this morning."
She gave directions grudgingly. For a moment Elaine thought she intended to scorn the pennies, but on the point of turning away the girl snatched the silver from her hand without so much as a word of thanks, pausing only to tuck them into the neck of her dress, of all places, before she set to swinging her broom, as if to beat the floor to death. Perhaps she had a pocket sewn in there. "You see," Nynaeve grumbled under her breath. "You mark me. He tried to push his attentions on that young woman. That's the sort of man you want me to apologize to." Elaine said nothing, only led the way up the railless steps at the back of the room. If Nynaeve did not stop complaining. The first hallway on the right, the girl had said, and the last door on the left, but in front of it she hesitated, biting her lower lip. Nynaeve brightened. "You see it's a bad idea now, don't you? We aren't Aiel, Elaine. I like the girl well enough for all she's forever fondling that knife of hers, but just think of the absolute drivel she talked. It's impossible. You must know it is." "We did not agree to anything impossible, Nynaeve." Keeping her voice firm took an effort. Some of what Avienda had suggested, apparently in all seriousness, she actually had suggested letting the man switch them. "What we did agree to is quite possible." "Barely." She rapped loudly on the paneled door with her knuckles. There was a fish carved on the door, a round thing with stripes and a snout. All of the doors had different carvings, most of fish. There was no answer. Nynaeve puffed out a breath she must have been holding. "Perhaps he has gone out. We'll just have to come back another time." "At this hour?" she rapped once more. "You say he always lies abed when he can." Still no sound from inside. "Elaine, if Birgitta is any indication, Matt got himself juicy as a fiddler last night. He won't thank us for waking him. Why don't we just go away and—" Elaine lifted the latch and went in. Nynaeve followed with a sigh that could have been heard back in the palace. Matt Coffin was sprawled on his bed atop the knitted red coverlet, a folded cloth lying over his eyes and dripping onto the pillow. The room was not very tidy, despite the absence of dust. A boot stood on the washstand. The washstand, next to a white basin full of unused water. The stand mirror sat askew, as if he had stumbled into it and simply left it tilted back sharply, and his wrinkled coat lay tossed across a ladder-backed chair. He wore everything else, including that black scarf he seemed never to take off, and the other boot. The silver fox head dangled from his unlaced shirt. The medallion made her fingers itch. If he really was lying there sodden with drink, she might be able to remove it unfelt. One way or another, she intended to find out how the thing absorbed the power. Finding out how almost anything worked was a fascination to her, but that fox head was all the puzzles in the world rolled into one. Nynaeve caught her sleeve and jerked her head toward the door, silently mouthing, "Asleep," and something else she could not make out. Probably another plea to go. "Leave me alone, Nerim," he mumbled suddenly. "I told you before, I don't want anything but a new skull. And close the door softly or I'll pin your ears to it." Nynaeve jumped and tried to pull her toward the door, but she stood her ground. "It is not Nerim, Master Coffin." Raising his head from the pillow, he used both hands to lift the cloth a trifle and squint at them with reddened eyes. Grinning, Nynaeve made no effort at all to hide her pleasure at his wretched state. What Elaine could not understand at first was why she wanted to grin, too. Her one experience with drinking too much had left her with nothing but pity and sympathy for anyone so snared. In the back of her mind, she felt Birgitta's head throbbing still, and it came to her. Certainly she could not like Birgitta drowning herself in drink, whatever the reason, but neither could she like the thought that anyone could do anything at all better than her first warder. A ridiculous thought. Embarrassing. But satisfying, too. "What are you doing here?" he demanded hoarsely, then winced and lowered his voice. "It's the middle of the night." "It's morning," Nynaeve said sharply. "Don't you remember talking with Birgitta?"
"Could you not be so loud?"
he whispered, closing his eyes. The next instant they popped open again. "Birgitta?" Sitting up abruptly, he swung his legs over the side of the bed. For a time he just sat there, peering at the floorboards, elbows on his knees and the medallion swinging from its thong around his neck. At last he turned his head to look at them balefully, or perhaps his eyes just made it seem so.
"What did she tell you?"
"She informed us of your demands, Master Cawthon," Elaine said formally. This must be how it felt to stand before the headsman's block. There was nothing for it but to keep her head high and face whatever came proudly. "I wish to thank you from my heart for rescuing me from the Stone of Tyr." There, she had begun, and it had not hurt. Not very much. Nynaeve stood there glowering, her lips growing tighter and tighter. The woman was not going to leave her to do this alone. Elaine embraced the source almost before she thought, and channeled a thin flow of air that flicked Nynaeve's earlobe like a snapping finger. The woman clapped a hand to her ear and glowered, but Elaine simply turned coolly back to Master Cawthon and waited. "I thank you, too," Nynaeve mumbled sullenly at last. "From the heart." Elaine rolled her eyes in spite of herself. Well, he had asked them to speak more softly, and he did seem to hear. Strangely, he shrugged with embarrassment. "Oh, that. It was nothing. Likely thing you'd have gotten yourself free in another tick without me." His head sank to his hands, and he pressed the damp cloth to his eyes once more. "On your way out, would you ask Kyra to bring me some wine punch? A slender girl, pretty, with a warm eye?"
Elaine quivered. Nothing? The man demanded an apology. She humbled herself to give it, and now it was nothing? He was not deserving of sympathy or pity. She still held Sidar, and she considered thumping him with a much thicker flow than she had used on Nynaeve. Not that that would do any good so long as he wore the fox head. Then again it hung loose, not touching him. Did it offer the same protection when it was not? Nynaeve ended her speculation by lunging for him, fingers clawed. Elaine managed to put herself between them and seize the other woman by the shoulders. For a stretched moment they stood nose to nose, except for the difference in their heights. With a grimace, Nynaeve finally relaxed, and Elaine felt it was safe to release her. The man still had his head bowed, all unaware. Whether the medallion protected him or not, she could snatch his bow stave from the corner and beat him till he howled. She felt heat rise in her face. She had stopped Nynaeve from ruining everything only to think of ruining it herself. Worse, by the smirky, self-satisfied little smile the other woman gave her, she knew very well what had been in her head. "There is more, Master Cawthon," she announced, squaring her shoulders. The smile vanished from Nynaeve's face. "We also wish to apologize for delaying so long in giving you your much-deserved thanks. And we apologize, humbly," she stumbled a little on that, "for the way we have treated you since." Nynaeve stretched out a beseeching hand that she ignored. "To show the depth of our regret, we undertake the following promises." Avienda had said an apology was only a beginning. "We will not belittle or demean you in any way, nor shout at you for any reason, nor attempt to give you orders." Nynaeve winced. Elaine's mouth tightened too, but she did not stop. "Recognizing your due concern for our safety, we will not leave the palace without telling you where we are going, and we will listen to your advice." Light! She had no wish to be Aiel. No wish to do any of this, but she wanted Avienda's respect. If you decide that we are..." Not that she had any intention of becoming a sister-wife. The very idea was indecent, but she did like her. "Are putting ourselves in needless danger..." It was not Avienda's fault that Rand had caught both their hearts, and Min's as well. "We will accept bodyguards of your choosing. Fate, or Taviran, or whatever, what was, was. She loved both women like sisters. And keep them with us as long as possible." Burn the man for doing this to her! It was not Matt Coffin she meant. "This I swear by the Lion Throne of Andor." She breathed in as if she had run a mile. Nynaeve wore a face like a cornered badger. His head swiveled toward them ever so slowly, and he lowered the cloth just enough to expose one red-streaked eye. "You sound like you have an iron rod down your throat, my lady," he said mockingly. "You have my permission to call me Matt." Odious man! He would not know civility if it bit him on the nose. That sanguine eye slanted toward her. "What about you, Nynaeve? I heard a lot of we from her, but not a word from you." "I won't shout at you," Nynaeve shouted. "And all the rest, too. I promise you... She gobbled on the edge of swallowing her tongue as she realized she could not call him one of the names he warranted without breaking the promise already. And yet the effect of her shout was most gratifying. With a cry, he shuddered and dropped the cloth, clutched his head with both hands. His eyes bulged. "Flaming dice," he whimpered, or something very like. It suddenly struck Elaine that he would be a very good source of pithy language. Stablemen and the like always seemed to scrape their tongues clean the moment they saw her. Of course she had promised herself to civilize him, to make him useful to Rand, but that need not interfere too much with his language. In fact, she realized there was a good deal she had not promised not to do. Pointing that out should settle Nynaeve considerably. After a long moment he spoke in a hollow voice. "Thank you, Nynaeve." He paused to swallow hard. "I thought you two must be somebody else in disguise there for a bit. Since I still seem to be alive, we might as well take care of the rest of it. I seem to recall that Birgitta said you wanted me to find something for you." "What?" "You won't find it," Nynaeve told him in a firm voice. Well, perhaps more hard than firm, but Elaine did not think of calling her down. He merited every wince. "You will accompany us, and we will find it." "Backtracking already, Nynaeve?" Somehow he managed a derisive sneer, especially hideous with his eyes. "You just finished promising to do as I say. If you want to tame Ta'veren on a leash, go ask Rand or Perrin and see what answer you get." "We promised no such thing, Matrim Coffin," Nynaeve snapped, going up on her toes. "I promised no such thing." She looked about to fling herself at him again. Even her braid seemed to bristle. Elaine kept a better rein on her temper. They would get nowhere bludgeoning him. "We will listen to your advice and accept it, if it is reasonable, Master Matt," she chided gently. Surely he could not really believe they had promised to. Looking at him, though, she saw that he did. Oh, light! Nynaeve was right. He was going to be trouble. She held that rein firmly. Channeling again, she lifted his coat from the chair to a proper place on one of the pegs on the wall so she could sit, back straight, arranging her skirts carefully. Keeping her promises to Master Coffin, Matt, and to herself were going to be difficult, but nothing he said or did could touch her. Nynaeve eyed the only other place to sit, a low carved wooden footstool, and remained standing. One hand moved toward her braid before she folded her arms. Her foot tapped ominously. "The Atha'an Mier call it the Bowl of the Winds, Master Matt. It is a Turangrial." By the end, a light of excitement shone through his sickliness. "Now that would be a thing to find," he murmured. "In the Rahad." He shook his head and flinched. "I'll tell you this now. Neither of you is setting foot on the other side of the river without 4 or 5 of my red arms each. Not outside the palace, for that matter. Did Birgitta tell you about the note that was stuffed in my coat? I'm sure I told her. And there's Cardin and his dark friends. You can't tell me he isn't up to something." "Any sister who supports Egwene as Amarlin is in danger from the tower." Bodyguards everywhere? Light. A dangerous light shone in Nynaeve's eyes, and her foot tapped faster. "We cannot hide, Matt, and we will not. Jaikim Karadin will be taken care of in due course." They had not promised to tell him everything, and they could not let him be diverted. There are more important matters afoot.
Due course? He began, voice rising in disbelief, but Nynaeve cut him short.
4 or 5 each, she said sourly. That's ridic-.
Her eyes shut for a moment, and her tone became milder. Slightly milder.
I mean to say it isn't sensible. Elaine and me, Brigitta and Avienda, you don't have that many soldiers. Anyway, all we really need is you.
That last came out as though dragged. It was too much an admission.
Brigitta and Avienda don't need minders, he said absently. I suppose this Bowl of the Winds is more important than Caradin, but it doesn't seem right, letting dark friends walk loose.
Slowly Nynaeve's face turned purple. Elaine checked her own in the stand mirror, relieved to see she was maintaining her composure. On the outside, anyway. The man was reprehensible.
Minders? She was not sure which would be worse, that he had flung that offhand insult on purpose, or that he had done so without realizing.
She eyed herself in the mirror again and lowered her chin a trifle.
Minders? She was poise itself.
He studied them with those bloodshot eyes, but saw nothing, apparently.
"Was that all Brigitta told you?" he asked. And Nynaeve snapped back, "That was quite enough, I think, even for you."
Inexplicably, he looked surprised and quite pleased.
Nynaeve gave a start, then folded her arms around herself tighter. "Since you're in no condition to go anywhere with us now, don't scowl at me, Matt Cawthon. That isn't demeaning, it's simple truth. You can spend the morning moving yourself into the palace. And you needn't think we'll help carry your things. I didn't promise to be a packhorse."
"The wandering woman is plenty good enough," he began angrily, then stopped, a wondering expression spreading over his face. A horrified expression, Elaine would have said.
That should teach him to growl when he had a head like a melon. At least that was what hers had felt like the time she drank too much. Of course he would not learn from it. Men kept sticking their hands in the fire, thinking this time it would not burn, so Leany always said.
"You can hardly expect we'll find the bull the first time we try," Nynaeve went on, "Taviran or no. Going out each day will be much simpler if you don't have to come across the square."
If they did not have to wait for him every morning, was what she meant. According to her, drunkenness was not the only excuse he could find for lying in bed till all hours, far from it.
"Besides," Elaine added, "that way you can keep an eye on us."
Nynaeve made a sound in her throat, very close to a groan. Did she not see that he must be enticed? It was not as if she had promised to actually allow him to keep an eye on them. He seemed not to have heard her or Nynaeve. Haggard eyes stared right through her.
"Why did they bloody well have to stop now?" he moaned, so softly she barely heard. What under the light did he mean by that?
"The rooms are fit for a king, Master Matt. Tylin herself chose them, just down from her own. She has taken a very personal interest. Matt, you wouldn't have us offend the queen, would you?"
One look at his face, and Elaine hurriedly channeled to push open the window and empty the washbasin through it. If she had ever seen a man about to lose the contents of his stomach, he was staring red-eyed at her right that minute.
"I don't see why you're making such a fuss," she said. Actually, she supposed she did. Some of the serving women here probably let him paw them, but she doubted many in the palace would, if any. He would not be able to drink and gamble his nights away, either. Tylin surely would not allow a bad example for Beslan.
"We all must make sacrifices."
With an effort, she stopped there, not telling him that his was small and only right, theirs monstrous and unjust, no matter what Avienda said. Nynaeve had certainly railed against any sacrifice. He put his head in his hands again, making strangled noises while his shoulders shook. He was laughing. She hefted the basin on a flow of air, considering hitting him with it. When he raised his eyes again, though, he looked outraged for some reason.
"Sacrifices!" he snarled. If I asked you to make the same, you'd box every ear in sight and pull the roof down on my head. Could he still be drunk? She decided to ignore his frightful glare. Speaking of your head, if you would like healing, I'm sure Nynaeve would oblige. If she had ever been angry enough to channel, she was now. Nynaeve gave a small jerk and glanced at her from the corner of one eye. Of course, she said hurriedly. If you want. The color in her cheeks confirmed all of Elaine's suspicions about that morning. Gracious as ever, he sneered. You just forget my head. I do very well without eyes, said I. And then, just to confuse matters, she was sure, he added in a hesitant voice, I thank you for asking, though. Almost as if he meant it. Elaine managed not to gape. Her knowledge of men was limited to Rand and what Linny and her mother had told her. Was Rand going to be as confusing as Matt Cawthon? Last thing before going, she remembered to secure a promise that he would start moving to the palace immediately. He kept his word once given, so Nynaeve had made clear, however reluctantly, but leave one crack, and he could find 100 ways to slip through. That she had been all too eager to emphasize. He gave his promise with a bleak, resentful grimace, or maybe that was just his eyes again. When she set the basin down at his feet, he actually looked grateful. She would not feel sympathy. She would not. Once back in the corridor with the door to Matt's room closed, Nynaeve shook her fist at the ceiling. That man could try the patience of a stone. I'm glad he wants to cuddle with his head. Do you hear me? Glad. He will make trouble. He will. You two will make more trouble for him than he ever could. The speaker stalked down the hall toward them. A woman with a touch of gray in her hair, a strong face, and a commanding voice. She also wore a frown little short of a scowl. Despite the marriage knife hanging into her cleavage, she was too fair for an Ebu Dari. I couldn't believe it when Kyra told me. I doubt I've ever seen so much foolishness poured into just 2 dresses. Elaine eyed the woman up and down. Not even as a novice had she gotten used to being addressed in that tone. Elaine eyed the woman up and down. Not even as a novice had she gotten used to being addressed in that tone. And who might you be, my good woman? I might be and am Satala Anan, the owner of this inn, child, was the dry reply. And with that, the woman flung open a door across the hallway, seized them each by an arm, and hustled them through so fast Elaine thought her slippers had left the floor. "You seem under some misapprehension, Mistress Anan," she said coolly as the woman released them to shut the door. Nynaeve was in no mood for niceties. Holding her hand so her great serpent ring was plain, she said heatedly, "Now you look here!" "Very pretty," the woman said, and pushed each of them so hard they found themselves sitting side by side on the bed. Elaine's eyes popped in disbelief. This Anan woman confronted them, grim-faced, fists on her hips, for all the world like a mother about to castigate her daughters. "Flaunting that just shows how silly you are. That young man will dandle you on his knee, one on each, I shouldn't wonder if you allow. He'll take a few kisses, and as much else as you're willing to give, but he won't harm you. You can harm him, though, if you keep on with this."
Harm him? The woman thought they... She thought he had dandled... She thought...
Elaine did not know whether to laugh or cry, but she stood up, straightening her skirts.
"As I said, Mistress Anan, you are under a misapprehension."
Her voice became smoother as she went on, confusion giving way to calm.
"I am Elaine Trakand, daughter heir of Andor and Aes Sedai of the Green Aja. I don't know what you think..."
Her eyes nearly crossed, as Mistress Anan pushed a finger to the tip of her nose. "Elaine, if that is your name, all that keeps me from dragging you down to the kitchen and washing your mouth out, yours and that other foolish girl's there, is the possibility that you actually can channel somewhat. Or are you silly enough to wear that ring when you can't even do that? I warn you, it will make no difference to the sisters over in the Tarasin Palace. Do you even know about them? If you do, frankly, you are not foolish, you're blind stupid. Elaine's temper grew by the word. Foolish girl? Blind? Stupid? She would not put up with it, especially not right after being forced to crawl to Matt Cawthon. Dandel? Matt Cawthon? She maintained her outward composure, though, but not so Nynaeve. She glared in a fury, and the glow of Sidar enveloped her as she bounded to her feet. Flows of air wrapped Mistress Annan from shoulders to ankles, crushing her skirts and petticoats against her legs, just short of tight enough to topple her. "I happen to be one of those sisters in the palace, Nynaeve Almira of the Yellow Aja, to be exact. Now would you like me to carry you down to the kitchens? I know something of how to wash out a mouth." Elaine stepped away from the innkeeper's outstretched arm. The woman had to feel the pressure of the flows, and even a half-wit would have known what those invisible bonds must be, yet she did not blink. Her green-flecked eyes narrowed no more. "So one of you can channel, at least," she said calmly. "I should let you drag me downstairs, child. Whatever you do to me, you would be in the hands of real Aes Sedai by noon, I'll wager that." "Didn't you hear me?" Nynaeve demanded. The Annan woman did not even pause. "You'll not only spend the next year blubbering, you will do part of it in front of anyone you told that you were Aes Sedai. Be sure they'll make you tell. They will turn your liver to water. I should let you go blundering on your way, or else run across to the palace as soon as you loose me. The only reason I don't is that they'll make an example of Lord Matt nearly as much as of you, if they even suspect he's helped you, and, as I said, I like the young man." "I'm telling you," Nynaeve tried again, but still the innkeeper gave her no chance to tell anything. Tied like a bundle, the woman was a boulder rolling downhill. She was the whole hillside falling, flattening whatever lay in its path. "Trying to keep up the lie does no good, Nynaeve. You look to be, 21, give or take a year, so you might be as much as 10 years older if you've already reached the slowing. You might even have worn the shawl 4 or 5 years, except for one thing." Her head, the only part of her she could move, swiveled toward Elaine. "You, child, aren't old enough to have slowed yet, and no woman has ever worn the shawl as young as you. Never in the history of the tower. If you ever were in the tower, I'll wager you wore white and squeaked every time the mistress of novices glanced your way. You had some goldsmith make that ring for you. There are some fool enough, I hear. Or maybe Nynaeve stole it for you, if she has any right to hers. Either way, since you can't be a sister, neither can she. No Aes Sedai would travel with a woman who was pretending." Elaine frowned, not noticing that she was chewing her lower lip. Slowed, slowing. How did an innkeeper in Ebu Dar know those words? Maybe Setala Annan had gone to the tower as a girl, though she would not have remained long, since she clearly could not channel. Elaine would have known, even if her ability had been as small as her own mother's, and Morgay's Trakand had had an ability so small she would have been sent away in a matter of weeks, probably, had she not then been daughter-heir. "Release her, Nynaeve," she said, smiling. She truly did feel more well-disposed toward the woman now. It must have been terrible to make that journey to Tar Valon, only to be turned away. There was no reason the woman had to believe them. Something tickled at that, but she could not say what. No reason at all. But if she had made the trip to Tar Valon, maybe she would walk across the Mulhara. Marilla or any of the other sisters could set her straight. "Release her!" Nynaeve yelped. "Elaine!"
"Release her. Mistress Annan, I see the only way to convince you is..."
"The Ammerlin's seat and 3 sitters couldn't convince me, child." Light, did she ever let anyone finish a sentence? "Now, I don't have time for any more games. I can help the pair of you. I know those who can, anyway, some women who take in strays. You can thank Lord Matt that I'm willing to take you to them, but I must know. Were you ever in the tower, or are you Wilders? If you were there, were you put out, or did you run away? The truth. They handle each in a different way." Elaine shrugged. They had done what they came for. She was more than ready to stop wasting time and get on with what needed doing next.
"If you won't be convinced, then that's all there is to it. Nynaeve, it is past time we were on our way."
The flows around the innkeeper vanished, and the glow around Nynaeve, too. But Nynaeve stood there watching the woman warily, hopefully. She wet her lips.
"You know a group of women who can help us?"
"Nynaeve," Elaine said. "We don't need any help. We are Aes Sedai, remember?" With a wry glance in her direction, Mistress Annan gave her skirts a shake to straighten them, and bent to smooth her exposed petticoats. Her real attention was on Nynaeve. Elaine had never felt so completely shunted aside in her life.
"I know a few women who take in the occasional wilder or runaway, or woman who failed her test for accepted or the shawl. There must be at least 50 of them altogether, though the number changes. They can help you find a life without the risk of a real sister making you wish she'd just skin you and be done. Now don't lie to me. Were you ever in the tower? If you've run away, you might as well decide to go back. The tower managed to find most runaways even during the War of the 100 Years, so you needn't think this little bother now will stop them. In truth, my suggestion then would be to go across the square and throw yourself on a sister's mercy. It will be a small mercy, I'm afraid, but you can believe me, it's more than you'll find if they have to drag you back. You won't even think of so much as leaving the tower grounds without permission after that."
Nynaeve drew a deep breath. "We were told to leave the tower, Mistress Annan. I will swear to that, however you ask." Elaine stared in disbelief.
"Nynaeve, what are you saying? Mistress Annan, we are Aes Sedai."
The Annan woman laughed.
"Child, let me talk with Nynaeve, who at least seems old enough to have sense. You tell the circle that, and they will not take it kindly. They won't care you can channel. They can, too. And they'll smack your bottom or toss you out in the street on your nose if you play the fool."
"Who is this circle?" Elaine demanded.
"We are Aes Sedai. You come across to the Tarasin Palace and you will see."
"I'll keep her in hand," Nynaeve had the gall to say, all the while frowning and grimacing at Elaine as if she were the one who had gone mad. The Annan woman merely nodded.
"Good. Now take off those rings and put them away. The circle doesn't allow that sort of pretending. They'll have them melted down to give you a start. Though by the look of your dresses, you have coin. If you stole it, don't let Rihanna know. One of the first rules you'll have to learn is don't steal even if you are starving. They don't want to draw attention."
Elaine made a fist and thrust it behind her back, and watched Nynaeve meekly slip her ring off and tuck it into her belt pouch. Nynaeve, who howled every time Marilla or Adelius or any of them forgot she was a full sister.
"Trust me, Elaine," Nynaeve said.
Which Elaine would have had an easier time of if she had any notion what the woman was up to. Still, she did trust her, mostly.
"A small sacrifice," she muttered.
Aes Sedai did go without their rings when the need arose, and she had too while passing for a sister. But it was hers by right now. Removing that band of gold almost hurt physically.
"Talk to your friend, child," the Annan woman told Nynaeve impatiently. "Rihanna Corley won't put up with all this sulky pouting, and if you make me waste my morning for nothing. Come along, come along. It's lucky for you I like Lord Matt."
Elaine held on to cool composure by a fingernail.
"Sulky pouting? Sulky pouting?"
When she had the chance, she was going to kick Nynaeve where it hurt. Chapter 23. Next Door to a Weaver. Nynaeve did want to talk to Elaine, away from the innkeeper's ears, but she did not find the chance right away. The woman marched them out of the room, doing a fine imitation of a guard on prisoners, her stony impatience undented by the wary look she cast at Matt's door. At the back of the inn, a set of unrailed stone steps led down into a large, hot kitchen full of baking smells, where the roundest woman Nynaeve had ever seen was wielding a large wooden spoon like a scepter, directing three others in sliding crusty brown loaves from the ovens and replacing them with rolls of pale dough. A large pot of the coarse white porridge that was eaten for breakfast hereabout bubbled gently on one of the white-tiled stoves.
"Enid," Mistress Anan addressed the round woman, "I'm going out for a little while. I need to take these two children to someone who has time to mother them properly."
Wiping broad, floury hands on a piece of white toweling, Enid studied Nynaeve and Elaine disapprovingly. Everything about her was round, her sweaty, olive-skinned face, her dark eyes, all of her. She seemed made of very large balls stuffed into a dress. The marriage knife she wore hanging outside her snowy apron sparkled with a full dozen stones.
"Is this the pair of barkers Kyra was chattering about, mistress? Fancy bits for the young lord's taste, I'd have said. He likes them with a bit of wiggle."
That amused her by her tone. The innkeeper shook her head in vexation. "I told that girl to hold her tongue. I won't let that sort of rumor touch the wandering woman. Remind Kyra for me, Enid, and use your spoon to get her attention if need be." The gaze she turned on Nynaeve and Elaine was so disparaging that Nynaeve nearly gasped.
Would anyone with half their wits believe these two were Aes Sedai? Spent all their coin on dresses to impress the man, and now they'd starve unless they smile for him. Aes Sedai.
Giving Enid no chance to answer, she seized Nynaeve's ear with her right hand, Elaine's with her left, and in three quick steps had them out into the stable yard. That was as long as Nynaeve's shock held. Then she pulled free, or tried to, because the woman let go at the same instant, and she stumbled half a dozen paces, glaring indignantly. She had not bargained for being dragged about. Elaine's chin rose, her blue eyes so cold Nynaeve would not have been surprised to see frost forming in her curls. Hands on her hips, Mistress Anan seemed not to notice. Or perhaps she simply did not care.
"I can hope no one in there believes Kyra after that," she said calmly. "If I could have been sure you had the wits to keep your mouths shut, I'd have said and done more and made certain."
She was calm, but not at all pleasant or soft. They had troubled her morning.
"Now follow me and don't get lost. Or if you do, do not show your faces anywhere near my inn again, or I'll send somebody to the palace to tell Marilla and Teslin. They are two of the real sisters, and they'll probably rip you each down the middle and share you out."
Elaine shifted her gaze from the innkeeper to Nynaeve. Not a glare or a frown, yet a very meaning look just the same. Nynaeve wondered whether she was going to be able to go through with this. The thought of Matt convinced her. Any chance was better than that. "We won't lose ourselves, Mistress Anan," she said, striving for meekness. She thought she did fairly well, considering how foreign meekness was to her. "Thank you for helping us." Smiling at the innkeeper, she did her best to ignore Elaine, whose stare became more meaningful, hard as that was to credit. Looks or no looks, she had to make sure the woman continued to think them worth the trouble. "We are truly grateful, Mistress Anan." Mistress Anan eyed her askance, then sniffed and shook her head. When this was done, Nynaeve decided, she was going to drag the innkeeper to the palace if need be, and make the other sisters acknowledge her in Mistress Anan's presence. This early, the stable yard was empty, save for a lone boy of 10 or 12 with a bucket and a sieve, who sprinkled water to dampen the hard-packed ground against dust. The white-plastered stable's doors were wide open, and a barrow sat in front with a dung fork resting across it. Sounds like a huge frog being stepped on floated out. Nynaeve decided it was a man singing. Would they have to ride to reach their destination? Even a short journey would not be pleasant. Walking only across the square and meaning to be back before the sun rose very high, they had brought neither hats nor parasols nor hooded cloaks. Mistress Anan led them through the stable yard, however, down a narrow alleyway between the stable and a high wall, that had drought-bedraggled trees poking above the top. Someone's garden, no doubt. A small gate at the end let into a dusty alley, so cramped Dawn had not completely reached it yet.
"You children keep up now, mind you," the innkeeper told them, starting away down the dim alley. "You lose yourselves, and I vow I'll go to the palace myself."
Nynaeve took a grip on her braid with both hands as she followed, to keep them from the Anan woman's throat. How she yearned for her first gray hairs! First the other Aes Sedai, then the sea folk. Light, she did not want to think about them. And now an innkeeper! No one took you seriously unless you had at least a little gray. Even an Aes Sedai's ageless face could not possibly do as well in her estimation. Elaine was lifting her skirts out the dust, though their slippers still kicked up little puffs that settled on the hems of their dresses. "Let me see," Elaine said softly, looking straight ahead. Softly, but coolly. Very coolly, in fact. She had a way of slashing someone to tatters without letting her tone heat that Nynaeve admired, usually. Now it just made her want to box the other woman's ears. "We could be back in the palace, drinking blueberry tea and enjoying the breezes, while we waited for Master Cawthon to move his belongings. Perhaps Avienda and Birgitta might return with something useful. We could finally be settling exactly what to do with the man. Do we simply follow him along the streets of the Rahad and see what happens, or take him into buildings that look likely, or let him choose? There must be 100 worthwhile uses for this morning, including deciding whether it's safe to go back to Egwene, ever, after that bargain the sea folk wrung out of us. We have to talk about that sooner or later. Ignoring it won't help. Instead, we are off on a walk of who knows what length, squinting into the sun the whole way, if we keep on as we are, to visit women who feed runaways from the tower. Myself, I don't have much interest in catching runaways this morning or any morning, but I'm sure you can explain it, so I will understand. I do so want to understand, Nynaeve. I would hate to think I'm going to kick you the length of the Mulhara for nothing." Nynaeve's eyebrows drew down. Kick her? Elaine really was becoming violent, spending so much time with Avienda. Someone ought to slap some sense into that pair. "The sun isn't high enough to make us squint yet," she muttered. "It would be soon, unfortunately. Think, Elaine. 50 women who can channel, helping wilders and women put out of the tower." She felt guilty sometimes using the term wilders. In the mouths of most Aes Sedai, it was an insult, but she intended to make them speak it as a badge of pride one day. And she called them the Circle. That doesn't sound like a few friends to me. It sounds organized. The alley meandered between high walls and the backs of buildings, many showing bare brick through the plaster. Between palace gardens and shops where an open back door revealed silversmiths, or tailors, or woodcarvers at work. Every so often Mistress Anan looked over her shoulder to make sure they still followed. Nynaeve gave her smiles and nods she hoped would convey eagerness. "Nynaeve, if 2 women who could channel made a society, the tower would fall on them like a pack of wolves. How would Mistress Anan know whether they can or not anyway? Women who can and aren't Aes Sedai do not go about making a show of themselves, you know. Not for very long, anyway. In any case, I can't see it makes a difference. Egwene might want to bring every woman who can channel into the tower somehow, but that is not what we are about here." The frosty patience in Elaine's voice tightened Nynaeve's hands on her braid. How could the woman be so dense? She bared her teeth again for Mistress Anan, and managed not to scowl at the innkeeper's back when her head turned forward once more. 50 women isn't 2, Nynaeve whispered fiercely. They could channel. They must be able to. Everything hinged on that. It's beyond reason that this circle can be in the same city with a storeroom packed full of Angreal and such, without at least knowing of it. And if they do... She could not keep satisfaction from honeying her voice. We'll have found the bull without Master Matrim Cawthon. We can forget those absurd promises. They were not a bribe, Nynaeve, Elaine said absently. I will keep them, and so will you, if you have any honor, and I know you do. She was spending entirely too much time with Avienda. Nynaeve wished she knew why Elaine had begun thinking they all had to follow this preposterous Aiel Jeep, whatever it was. Elaine bit her underlip, frowning. All that iciness seemed to have vanished. She was herself again, apparently. Finally, she said, "We would never have gone to the inn without Master Cawthon, so we'd never have met the remarkable Mistress Anan, or been taken to this circle. So if the circle does lead us to the bowl, we have to say he was the root cause." Matt Cawthon. His name boiled in her head. Nynaeve stumbled over her own feet and let go of her braid to lift her skirts. The alley was hardly as smooth as a paved square, much less a palace floor. At times, Elaine in a taking was better than Elaine thinking clearly. "Remarkable," she muttered. "I'll remarkable her till her eyes cross. No one has ever treated us this way, Elaine. Not even people who doubted. Not even the sea folk. Most people would step wary if a 10-year-old said she was Aes Sedai." "Most people don't really know what an Aes Sedai's face looks like, Nynaeve. I think she went to the tower once. She knows things she couldn't otherwise." Nynaeve snorted, glowering at the back of the woman striding ahead. Sitala Anan might have been to the tower 10 times, 100, but she was going to acknowledge Nynaeve Almira as Aes Sedai, and apologize, and learn what it was like to be hauled about by her ear, too. Mistress Anan glanced back, and Nynaeve flashed her a rigid smile, nodded as if her neck was a hinge. "Elaine, if these women do know where the bowl is, we don't have to tell Matt how we found it." That was not quite a question. "I don't see why," Elaine replied, then dashed all her hopes by adding, "But I'll have to ask Avienda to be sure." If she had not thought the Anan woman might abandon them on the spot, Nynaeve would have screamed. The wandering alley gave way to a street, and there was no talking then to amount to anything. The sun's thin rim glared blindingly above the rooftops ahead. Elaine shaded her eyes with one hand very ostentatiously. Nynaeve refused to. It was not that bad. She barely had to squint at all, really. A clear blue sky mocked her weather sense. That still told her a storm was right on top of the city. Even this early, a few brightly lacquered coaches were about in the winding streets, and a double fistful of brighter sedan chairs, two or sometimes four barefoot bearers in green and red striped vests to each, trotting because they carried passengers, hidden behind the grilled wooden screens. Carts and wagons rumbled over the paving stones, and people began to fill the streets as shop doors opened and awnings went up, vested apprentices hurrying on errands, and men with great rolled carpets balanced on their shoulders, tumblers and jugglers and musicians readying themselves at likely corners, and hawkers with their trays of pins or ribbons or shabby fruit. The open-sided fish and meat markets had long since been in full cry. All the fishmongers were women, and most of the butchers, too, except those dealing in beef. Dodging through the crowds, past the coaches and sedan chairs and wagons that seemed to think they had no reason to slow, Mistress Anan set a fast pace to make up for interruptions. There were plenty of those. She seemed to be a well-known woman, hailed by shopkeepers and craftsmen and other innkeepers standing in their doorways. The shopkeepers and craftsmen received a few words, a pleasant nod, but she always stopped to chat a moment with the innkeepers. After the first, Nynaeve wished fervently that she would not again. After the second, she prayed for it. After the third, she stared straight ahead and tried in vain not to hear. Elaine's face grew tighter and tighter, colder and colder. Her chin rose till it was a wonder she could see to walk. There was a reason, Nynaeve had to admit grudgingly. In Ebu Dar, someone wearing silk might stroll the length of a square, maybe, but no further. Everybody else in sight wore wool or linen, seldom with much embroidery, except for an occasional beggar who had acquired a cast-off silk garment, frayed on every edge and more whole than cloth. She just wished Mistress Anan had chosen some other explanation for why she was leading the pair of them through the streets. She wished she did not have to listen one more time to a tale of two flighty girls who had spent all their money on fine clothes to impress a man. Matt came out of it well, burn him. A fine young fellow, if Mistress Anan had not been married. A beautiful dancer with just a touch of the rogue. All of the women laughed. Not her or Elaine, though. Not the brainless little honey-kissers. That was the word she used. Nynaeve could guess what it meant. Honey-kissers, penniless from chasing after a man, and their purses full of brass bits and tin to fool fools. Witless lubies, who would have been reduced to beggary or theft, had Mistress Anan not known someone who might give them work in the kitchen.
"She doesn't have to stop at every inn in the city," Nynaeve growled as she stalked away from the stranded goose.
Three broad stories with an innkeeper who wore large garnets at her ears, despite the humble name. Mistress Anan hardly even glanced back to see they followed now.
"Do you realize we'll never be able to show our own faces in any of those places?"
I suspect that is exactly the point.
Every word out of Elaine's mouth was chipped from ice.
Nynaeve, if you've sent us running after a wild pig...
There was no need to complete the threat.
With Birgitta and Avienda to help, and they would, Elaine could make her life miserable until she was satisfied.
They will take us right to the bowl, she insisted, flapping her hands to shoo a beggar with a horrible purple scar that obliterated one eye.
She could recognize flower paste dyed with blue wort when she saw it.
I know they will.
Elaine sniffed in an offensively expressive manner. Nynaeve lost count of the number of bridges they crossed, large and small, with barges poling beneath. The sun climbed its own height above the rooftops, then twice. The Anan woman did not follow even so straight a line as she might have. She really did seem to be going out of her way to find inns, but they continued generally east, and Nynaeve thought they must be nearing the river, when the hazel-eyed woman suddenly rounded on them.
"You watch your tongues now. Speak when you're spoken to, and not else. You embarrass me, and—"
With a final frown and a mutter half under her breath that she was probably making a mistake, she jerked her head for them to follow again to a flat-roofed house right opposite. It was not a large house, two stories without one balcony, cracked plaster and brick showing in several places, and hardly in an agreeable location, with the loud rattling of a weaver's looms to one side, and the acrid stinks of a dyer's shop to the other. A maid answered the door, though, a graying woman with a square jaw, shoulders like a blacksmith, and a steely eye unsoftened by the sweat on her face. As Nynaeve followed Mistress Anan in, she smiled. Somewhere in that house a woman was channeling. The square-jawed maid obviously knew Setala Anan on sight, but her reaction was odd. She curtsied with a very real respect, yet she was plainly surprised to see her and obviously doubtful about her being there. She almost fluttered before letting them in. Nynaeve and Elaine were greeted with no ambivalence, though. They were shown to a sitting room one flight up, and the maid told them firmly, "Don't stir a toe and don't touch anything, or you'll catch the old what for," then vanished.
Nynaeve looked at Elaine.
"Nynaeve, one woman channeling doesn't mean—" The field changed, swelling for a moment, then subsiding, lower than before.
"Even two women doesn't mean anything," Elaine protested, but she sounded doubtful.
That was the most ill-mannered maid I've ever seen. She took a tall-backed red chair, and after a moment Nynaeve sat too, but she perched on the edge. From eagerness, not nerves. Not nerves at all. The room was not grand, but the blue and white floor tiles glistened, and the pale green walls looked freshly painted. No trace of gilt showed anywhere, of course, yet fine carving covered the red chairs arrayed along the walls, and several small tables of a darker blue than the tiles. The lamps hanging from sconces were clearly brass, polished till they shone. Carefully arranged evergreen branches filled the swept hearth, and the lintel above the fireplace was carved, not plain stonework. The carving seemed an odd choice, what people around Ebu Dar called the 13 sins. A man with eyes that nearly filled his whole face for envy. A fellow with his tongue hanging to his ankles for gossip. A snarling, sharp-toothed man clutching coins to his chest for greed, and so on. But all in all, it satisfied her very much. Whoever could afford that room could afford fresh plaster outside, and the only reason not to put it up was to keep low, avoiding notice. The maid had left the door open, and suddenly voices coming up the hall drifted through.
I cannot believe you brought them here.
The speaker's tone was tight with incredulity and anger.
You know how careful we are, Satella. You know more than you should, and you surely know that.
I'm very sorry, Rihanna, Mistress Anan answered stiffly. I suppose I didn't think. I submit myself both to stand surety for these girls' behavior and to your judgment.
Of course not. Rihanna's tone was high with shock now. That is to say, I mean, you shouldn't have, but... Satella, I apologize for raising my voice. Say you forgive me.
You have no reason to apologize, Rihanna. The innkeeper managed to sound rueful and reluctant at the same time. I did wrong to bring them.
No, no, Satella, I shouldn't have spoken to you so. Please, you must forgive me. Please do.
The Anan woman and Rihanna Corley entered the sitting room, and Nynaeve blinked in surprise. From the exchange, she had expected someone younger than Satella Anan, but Rihanna had hair more gray than not, and a face full of what might have been smile lines, though they were creased in worry now. Why would the older woman humble herself so to the younger, and why would the younger allow it, however half-heartedly? Customs were different here, the light knew. Some more different than she liked to think about, yet not this much, surely. Of course, she had never gone very far toward being humble with the women's circle back home, but this... Of course, Rihanna could channel. She had expected that. Hoped for it, anyway. But she had not expected the strength. Rihanna was not as strong as Elaine, or even Nicola, burned that wretched girl. But she easily equaled Shiriam, say, or Kwamesa, or Kiruna. Not many women possessed so much strength, and for all she herself bettered it by a fair margin, she was surprised to find it here. The woman must be one of the Wilders. The tower would have found a way to keep its hands on a woman like this if they had to hold her in a novice dress her whole life. Nynaeve rose as they came through the doorway, smoothing her skirts. Not from nervousness, certainly. Certainly not. Oh, but if only this came out right... Rihanna's sharp blue eyes studied the two of them with the air of someone who had just found a pair of pigs in her kitchen, fresh from the sty and dripping mud. She dabbed at her face with a tiny handkerchief, though the interior of the house was cooler than outside.
"I suppose we'll have to do something with them," she murmured, "if they are what they claim."
Her voice was quite high even now, musical and almost youthful. As she finished speaking, she gave a small start for some reason, and eyed the innkeeper sideways, which set off another round of Mistress Anan's reluctant apologies and Mistress Corley's flustered attempts to deflect them. In Ebu Dar, when folk were truly being polite, apologies back and forth could flow for an hour. Elaine had risen too, wearing a slightly fixed smile. She raised an eyebrow at Nynaeve, cupped her elbow in one hand, and laid a finger against her cheek. Nynaeve cleared her throat. "Mistress Corley, my name is Nynaeve Almira, and this is Elaine Trakand. We are looking for... Satella has told me all about you," the blue-eyed woman cut in ominously. However many gray hairs on her head, Nynaeve suspected she was also hard as a stone fence. "Abide with patience, girl, and I'll deal with you directly." She turned back to Satella, blotting her cheeks with the handkerchief. Barely suppressed diffidence once more tinged her voice. "Satella, if you will please excuse me, I must question these girls, and—"
"Look who is returned after all these years," a short, stout woman in her middle years blurted as she barged into the room, nodding at her companion. Despite her red-belted Ebudari dress and a tanned face that glistened damply, her accents were pure Kyrianan. Her equally sweaty companion, in the dark, plainly cut woolens of a merchant, was a head taller, no older than Nynaeve, with dark, tilted eyes, a strongly hooked nose, and a wide mouth.
"It's Garinia! She—"
The flow of words terminated abruptly in confusion as the stout woman realized others were present. Rihanna clasped her hands as if in prayer, or perhaps because she wanted to hit someone.
"Berowin," she said with an edge. "One day you will run right off a cliff before you see it under your feet." "I am sorry, El—"
Blushing, the Kyrianin lowered her eyes. The Saldaean became intent on fiddling with a circle of red stones pinned at her breast. For Nynaeve's part, she gave Elaine a triumphant look. Both newcomers could channel, and Sidar was still being wielded somewhere in the house. Two more, and while Beroen was not very strong, Garinia stood even above Rhianna. She could match Lelaine or Romanda. Not that that mattered, of course, yet this made at least five. Elaine's chin set stubbornly, but then she sighed and gave a small nod. Sometimes it took the most incredible effort to convince her of anything. "Your name is Garinia?" Mistress Anand said slowly, frowning at the woman in question. "You look very much like someone I met once. Zarya Alkaza." Dark-tilted eyes blinked in surprise. Plucking a lace-trimmed handkerchief from her sleeve, the Saldaean merchant touched her cheeks. "That is my grandmother's sister's name," she said after a moment. "I'm told I favor her strongly. Was she well when you saw her? She forgot her family completely after she went off to become Aes Sedai." "Your grandmother's sister." The innkeeper laughed softly. "Of course. She was well when I saw her, but that was a long time ago. I was younger than you are now." Rhianna had been hovering at her side, all but grabbing her elbow, and now she leaped in. "Sitala, I truly am sorry, but I really must ask you to excuse us. You will forgive me not showing you to the door?" Mistress Anan made her own apologies, as if she was at fault because the other woman could not escort her down, and departed with a last, very dubious look at Nynaeve and Elaine. "Sitala!" Garinia exclaimed as soon as the innkeeper was gone. "That was Sitala Anan? How did she... Light of heaven! Even after 70 years, the tower would..." "Garinia," Mistress Corley said in an extremely sharp tone. Her stare was sharper still, and the Saldaean's face reddened. "Since you two are here, we can make up the three for questioning. You girls stay where you are and keep silent." That last was for Nynaeve and Elaine. The other women withdrew to a corner in a huddle and began conversing in soft murmurs. Elaine moved nearer Nynaeve. "I did not like being treated as a novice when I was a novice. How long do you intend to continue this farce?" Nynaeve hissed at her for quiet. "I'm trying to listen, Elaine," she whispered. Using the power was out of the question, of course. The three would have known on the instant. Fortunately, they wove no barriers, perhaps not knowing how, and sometimes their voices rose just enough. "Said they may be wilders," Rhianna said, and shock and revulsion bloomed on the other women's faces. "Then we show them the door," Beroen said. "The back door, wilders." "I still want to know who this Sitala Anan is," Garinia put in. "If you can't keep your mind on the straight," Rhianna told her, "perhaps you should spend this turn on the farm. Elise knows how to concentrate a mind wonderfully. Now." The words dropped back to a buzz. Another maid appeared, a slender woman, pretty except for a sullen expression, with a rough gray woolen dress and a long white apron. Setting a green lacquered tray on one of the small tables, she surreptitiously wiped her cheeks with a corner of her apron and began fussing with blue glazed cups and a matching teapot. Nynaeve's eyebrows rose. This woman could channel, too, if not to any high degree. What was she doing as a servant? Garinia glanced over her shoulder and gave a start. What did Daris do to earn penance? I thought fish would sing the day she cracked a rule, much less broke one. Beroen sniffed loudly, but her reply was barely audible. She wanted to marry. She will advance a turn and go with Karyla the day after the Feast of the Half-Moon. That will settle for Master Denal. Perhaps you both wish to hoe the fields for Elise? Rhianna spoke dryly, and the voices fell again. Nynaeve felt a rush of exultation. She did not care much for rules, at least for other people's rules. Other people rarely saw the situation as clearly as she, and thus made stupid rules. Why should that woman, Daris, not marry if she wished, for example? But rules and penances spoke of a society. She was right. And another thing. She nudged Elaine until the other woman bent her head. "Beroen's wearing a red belt," she whispered. That indicated a wise woman, one of Ebudar's fabled healers, their care known far and wide as the next best being healed by an Aes Sedai, curing just about anything. Supposedly it was all done with herbs and knowledge, but how many wise women have we seen, Elaine? How many could channel? How many were Ebudari, or even Altaran?
7, counting Beroen, was the slow answer. And only one, I was sure, was from here.
Ha! The others plainly had not been.
Elaine took a deep breath, though she went on softly. None had anywhere near these women's strength, though.
At least she had not suggested they were mistaken somehow. All of those wise women had been able.
Nynaeve, are you really suggesting that the wise women, all the wise women, are... That would be beyond incredible.
Elaine, this city has a guild for the men who sweep the squares every night. I think we've just found the ancient muckety-muck sisterhood of wise women. The stubborn woman shook her head.
The tower would have had 100 sisters here years ago, Nynaeve. 200. Anything of the sort would have been squashed flat in short order.
Maybe the tower doesn't know, Nynaeve said. Maybe the tower doesn't know, Nynaeve said. Maybe the guild keeps low enough that the tower never thought they were worth troubling. There's no law against channeling if you aren't Aes Sedai, only against claiming to be Aes Sedai or misusing the power, or bringing discredit. That meant doing anything that might possibly cast a bad light on real Aes Sedai should anyone happen to think you were one, which was going pretty far to her way of thinking. The real trouble, though, was that she did not believe it. The tower seemed to know everything, and they probably would break up a quilting circle if the women in it could channel. Yet there had to be some explanation for... Only half aware, she felt the true source being embraced, but suddenly she became very aware. Her mouth fell open as a flow of air snared her braid right at the base of her skull and ran her across the room on her toes. Elaine ran right beside her, red-faced with fury. The worst of it was they were both shielded. The short run ended when they were allowed to settle their heels in front of Mistress Corley and the other two, all three seated against the wall in red chairs, all surrounded by the glow of Sidar. "You were told to be quiet," Rihanna said firmly. "If we decide to help you, you will have to learn that we expect strict obedience no less than the White Tower itself." She imbued those last words with a tone of reverence. I will tell you that you would have been treated more gently if you had not come to us in this irregular fashion. The flow gripping Nynaeve's braid vanished. Elaine tossed her head angrily as she was released. Appalled astonishment became fiery outrage as Nynaeve realized that Beroen held her shield. Most Aes Sedai she had met stood above Beroen, nearly all. Gathering herself, she strained to reach the source, expecting the weaves to shatter. She would at least show these women she would not be. The weaves stretched. The round Kyrianan woman smiled, and Nynaeve's face darkened. The shield stretched further, further, bulging like a ball. It would not break. That was impossible. Anyone could block her from the source if they caught her by surprise, of course, and someone weaker could hold the shield once woven, but not this much weaker. And a shield did not bend that far without breaking. It was impossible. You could burst a blood vessel if you keep at that, Beroen said, almost companionably. We do not try to reach above our station, but skills are honed with time, and this was always nearly a talent with me. I could hold one of the Forsaken. Scowling, Nynaeve gave over. She could wait. Since she had no choice, she could. Darris came bearing her tray, distributing cups of dark tea to the three seated women. She never so much as glanced at Nynaeve or Elaine before making a perfect curtsy and returning to her table.
"We could have been drinking blueberry tea, Nynaeve," Elaine said, shooting such a look at her that she came close to stepping back. "Maybe it would be best not to wait too long." "Be quiet, girl."
Mistress Corley's tone might be calm, but she patted her handkerchief to her face angrily. Our report of you says you both are froward and contentious, that you chase after men and lie, to which I add that you cannot follow simple instructions, all of which must change if you seek our help. All of it,
This is most irregular. Be grateful we're willing to speak to you.
We do seek your help, Nynaeve said. She wished Elaine would stop glaring so. It was worse than the Corley woman's hard stare. Well, as bad, anyway.
We desperately need to find a Tarangreal.
Rhianna Corley broke in as if she had been standing there silent.
Usually we know the girls brought to us beforehand, but we must make certain you are what you say. How many doors to the tower library may a novice use, and which?
She took a sip of tea, waiting.
Two. The word dripped venom from Elaine's mouth. The main door to the east when a sister sends her, or the small door at the southwest corner called the novice door when she goes for herself. How long, Nynaeve?
Garinia, who held Elaine's shield, channeled another slender flow of air, not gently. Elaine quivered, then again, and Nynaeve winced, wondering that she did not grab at the back of her skirt.
A civil tongue is another requirement, Garinia murmured wryly into her cup.
That is the right answer, Mistress Corley said, as if nothing else had happened, although she did eye the Saldaean woman briefly over her tea.
Now, how many bridges in the water garden?
Three, Nynaeve snapped, mainly because she knew. She had not known about the library, having never been a novice.
We need to know. Berowyn could not spare anything to channel a flow of air, but Mistress Corley could, and did. Barely keeping her face smooth, Nynaeve knotted her hands in her skirts to hold them still. Elaine had the gall to give her a small, chilly smile. Chilly, but satisfied.
A dozen more questions hammered at them, from how many floors the novice quarters contained, 12, to under what circumstances a novice was allowed into the hall of the tower. To carry messages, or to be expelled from the tower for a crime, no others. Hammered without Nynaeve getting in more than two words, and those two answered silently by the horrible Corley woman. She began to feel like a novice in the hall. They were not allowed to speak a word either. That was one of the few answers she knew, but luckily Elaine responded promptly when she did not. Nynaeve might have done better had they asked about accepted, a little better at least, but it was what a novice should know that interested them. She was just glad Elaine was willing to go along, though by her pale cheeks and raised chin, that could not last much longer.
"I suppose Nynaeve was really there," Rhianna said finally, exchanging glances with the other two. "If Elaine taught her to pass, I think she would have done a better job. Some people live in perpetual fog."
Garinia sniffed, then nodded slowly. Berowyn's nod came entirely too promptly for Nynaeve's liking.
"Please," she said politely. She could be polite when there was reason, whatever anyone said.
"We truly need to find the Tarangreal the sea folk call the Bowl of the Winds. It's in a dusty old storeroom somewhere in the Rahad, and I think your guild, your circle, must know where. Please help us."
Three suddenly stony faces stared at her.
"There is no guild," Mistress Corley said coolly. "Only a few friends who found no place in the White Tower." Again that reverential tone.
"And who are foolish enough occasionally to reach out a hand where it's needed. We have no truck with Tarangreal or Angreal or Saangreal either. We are not Aes Sedai."
Aes Sedai echoed with veneration as well.
"In any case, you are not here to ask questions. We have more for you, to see how far you've gone, after which you will be taken to the country and given into the care of a friend. She will keep you until we decide what to do next, until we can be sure the sisters are not looking for you. You have a new life ahead of you, a new chance, if you can only let yourselves see it. Whatever held you back in the tower does not apply here, whether a lack of dexterity or fear or anything else. No one will push you to learn or do what you cannot. What you are is sufficient. Now."
"Enough," Elaine said in a wintry voice. "Long enough, Nynaeve. Or do you intend to wait in the country for however long? They do not have it, Nynaeve." Removing her great serpent ring from her belt pouch, she thrust the circle of gold onto her finger. From the way she looked at the seated women, no one would believe her shielded.
She was a queen out of patience. She was Aes Sedai to her hair was what she was.
I am Elaine Trakand, high seat of House Trakand. I am daughter heir of Andor and Aes Sedai of the Green Aja, and I demand you release me immediately.
Nynaeve groaned.
Garinia grimaced with disgust, and Berowyn's eyes widened in horror.
Rhianna Corley shook her head ruefully, but when she spoke, her voice was iron.
I had hoped Satala had changed your mind concerning that particular lie. I know how hard it is to set out proudly for the White Tower, then find yourself faced with returning home to admit failure. But that is never said, even in joke.
I made no joke, Elaine said lightly. Snow was light.
Garinia leaned forward with a scowl, a flow of air already forming until Mistress Corley raised her hand.
And you, Nynaeve? Do you persist in this madness, too?
Nynaeve filled her lungs.
These women had to know where the bowl was. They just had to. Nynaeve!
Elaine said peevishly. She was not going to let her forget this, even if they did have to effect an escape. She had a way of harping on every little misstep in a manner that cut the ground right from under your feet.
I am an Aes Sedai of the Yellow Aja, Nynaeve said wearily. The true Amarlin seat, Egwene Alvear, raised us to the shawl in Salidar. She's no older than Elaine, you must have heard. Not a glimmer of change in those three hard faces. She sent us to find the Bowl of the Winds. With it we can mend the weather. Not a flicker of change. She tried to hold her anger down. She truly did. It just oozed up despite her. You must want that. Look around you. The Dark One is strangling the world. If you have even a hint of where the bowl might be, tell us.
Mistress Corley motioned for Darris, who came and took the cups, casting fearful, wide-eyed looks at Nynaeve and Elaine. When she scurried away, out of the room, in fact, the three women stood slowly, standing like grim magistrates pronouncing sentence.
I regret that you will not accept our help, Mistress Corley said coldly. I regret this whole affair.
Reaching into her pouch, she pressed three silver marks into Nynaeve's hand, and another three into Elaine's.
These will take you a little way. You can also get something for those dresses, I should think, if not what you paid. Those are hardly suitable garments for a journey. By tomorrow sunrise, you will be gone from Ebu Dar.
We aren't going anywhere, Nynaeve told her.
Please, if you know...
She might as well have kept silent. The measured flow of words did not slow.
At that time we will begin circulating your descriptions, and we will make certain they reach the sisters in the Tarasin Palace. If you are seen after sunrise, we will see that the sisters know where you are, and the white cloaks as well. Your choice then will be to run, surrender to the sisters, or die. Go, do not return, and you should live long if you give over this repulsive and dangerous ruse. We are done with you. Berowyn, see to them, please.
Brushing between them, she went from the room without looking back.
Sullenly, Nynaeve let herself be herded down to the front door. A struggle would not achieve anything except maybe being thrown out bodily, but she did not like giving up. Like she did not. Elaine marched, frozen determination to leave and be done shining in every line of her. In the small entry hall, Nynaeve decided to try once more.
Please, Garinia, Berowyn, if you have any hint, tell us. Any clue at all. You must see how important this is. You must.
The blindest are those who keep their eyes shut, Elaine quoted, not quite under her breath.
Berowyn hesitated, but not Garinia. She put her face right in Nynaeve's.
Do you think we're fools, girl? I'll tell you this. If I had my way, we would bundle you out to the farm no matter what you say. A few months of Elise's attentions, and you'd learn to guard your tongue and be grateful for the help you spit on.
Nynaeve considered hitting her on the nose. She did not need Sidar to use her fist.
Garinia, Berowyn said sharply, apologize. We do not hold anyone against her will, and you know it well. Apologize immediately.
And wonder of wonders, the woman who would have stood very close to the top had she been Aes Sedai looked sideways at the woman who would have stood near the bottom and blushed crimson.
I ask forgiveness,
Garinia mumbled at Nynaeve. My temper gets the better of me sometimes, and I say what I have no right to. I humbly ask forgiveness. Another sidelong glance at Berowyn, who nodded, producing a sigh of open relief. While Nynaeve was still gaping, the shields were released, and she and Elaine were pushed into the street, the door slamming shut behind them. Chapter 24 The Kin. Incredible, Rihanna thought, watching from a window as the two strange girls vanished down the street among the tradesmen and beggars and occasional sedan chairs. She'd returned to the meeting room as soon as the pair was escorted from it. She did not know what to make of them, and their persistent claims in the face of all reason were only part of her confusion. They did not perspire, Berowyn whispered at her shoulder. Yes? She would have arranged for the news to reach the Tarasin Palace in the next hour if she had not given her word, and if not for the danger. Fear bubbled in her middle, the same panic that had overtaken her after one passage through the silver arches when she went to test for accepted. Just as she had every time it had stirred in the years since, she took a fresh grip on herself. In truth, she did not realize that the fear she might run screaming again had long since conquered any possibility that she would. She prayed that those girls would abandon their insanity. She prayed that if they did not, they were caught far from Ebu Dar and either kept silent or were not believed. Precautions would have to be taken, safeguards carried out that had not been used in years. Aes Sedai were as near omnipotent as made no difference, though. That she knew in her bones. Eldest, could it be possible that the older of the two really is? We channeled and... Berowyn trailed off miserably, but Rihanna did not need to consider, not even setting aside the younger girl. Why would any Aes Sedai pretend to be less, so much less? Besides, any real Aes Sedai would have put them all on their knees begging mercy, not stood there so submissively. We did not channel in front of an Aes Sedai, she said firmly. We broke no rule. Those rules applied to her as strictly as anyone else. The very first was that they were all one, even those set above for a time. How could it have been otherwise, when those who were above must eventually step down? Only through movement and change could they remain hidden. But some of the rumors do mention a girl as Amyrlin eldest, and she knew rebels. Rihanna put into that all the outraged disbelief she felt, that anyone should dare to rebel against the White Tower. It was hardly strange for unbelievable tales to attach to anyone like that. What about Loghain and the Red Aja? Garinia demanded, and Rihanna fixed her with a stare. The woman had gotten herself another cup of tea before coming back up, and she managed to sip defiantly. Whatever the truth, Garinia, it is not our place to criticize anything Aes Sedai might do. Rihanna's mouth tightened. That hardly squared with what she felt toward the rebels, but how could any Aes Sedai do such a thing? The Saldaean bent her neck in acquiescence, though, and perhaps to hide the sullen twist of her mouth. Rihanna sighed. She herself had given up dreams of the Green Aja long, long ago, but there were those like Berowyn who believed, secretly they thought, that somehow they might one day return to the White Tower, somehow yet become Aes Sedai. And then there were women like Garinia, almost as poor at keeping their wishes secret, though those wishes were 10 times as forbidden. They actually would have accepted wilders, and even gone out to find girls who could be taught. Garinia was not done. She always skirted the edges of discipline and frequently stepped over. What of this Setala Anan, then? Those girls know about the circle. The Anan woman must have told them, though how she knows. She shuddered, in a way that would have been entirely too ostentatious for most others, but she had never been able to conceal her emotions, even when she should. Whoever betrayed us to her must be found, and her betrayal punished too. She's an innkeeper, and she must be taught to guard her tongue. Berowyn gasped, wide-eyed with shock, and dropped into a chair so hard she nearly bounced. Remember who she is, Garinia, Rihanna said sharply. If Setala had betrayed us, we would be crawling to Tar Valon, begging forgiveness the whole way. When she first came to Ebu Dar, she'd been told the story of a woman made to crawl to the White Tower, and nothing she had seen since of Aes Sedai made her question it in the least. She has kept the few secrets she knows from gratitude, and I doubt that has faded. She would have died in her first childbirth if the kin had not helped her. What she knows comes from careless tongues, when it was thought she could not hear, and the owners of those tongues were punished more than 20 years ago. Still, she wished there was some way she could bring herself to ask Satala to be more circumspect. She must have spoken carelessly in front of those girls. The woman bowed her head again, but her mouth was set stubbornly. At least part of this turn, Rihanna decided, Garinia would spend at the retreat, and she would have special instructions to relay with her own stubborn mouth. Alice seldom required more than a week to make a woman decide stubbornness did not pay. Before she could inform Garinia, though, Darris was curtsying in the doorway, announcing Sarenya Vostovan. As usual, Sarenya swept right in before Rihanna could say to admit her. In some ways, the strikingly handsome woman made Garinia appear supple, despite keeping the form of every rule exactly. Rihanna was sure she would have worn her hair in braids and bells, given the choice, and never mind how that would have looked with her red belt. But then, given the choice, she would not have served even one turn with the belt. Sarenya did curtsy at the door, of course, and kneel before her, head lowered, but 50 years had not made her forget that she would have been a woman of considerable power had she been able to make herself return home to Arafel. Curtsy and the rest all were concessions. When she spoke in that husky, forceful voice, whether the woman would ever reconcile herself and the problem of Garinia left Rihanna's mind. "Kali is dead, eldest sister. Her throat was cut, and she apparently had been robbed even of her stockings, but Sumiko says that it was the one power killed her." "That is impossible," Beroin burst out. "No kinswoman would do such a thing." "And I said I?" Garinia said, hesitant for once. "But how? The three oaths. Sumiko must be wrong." Rihanna raised a hand for silence. "Sumiko was never wrong. Not in this area. She would have been yellow Aja had she not broken down completely while testing for the shawl, and although it was forbidden, despite countless penances, she worked to learn more whenever she thought no one was watching. No Aes Sedai could have done this, obviously, and no kinswoman would have, but those girls, so insistent, knowing what they should not. The circle had lasted too long, offered succor to too many women to be destroyed now. "This is what must be done," she told them. That flutter of fear began again, but for once she hardly noticed. Nynaeve stalked away from the small house in outrage. It was incredible. Those women did have a guild. She knew they did. Whatever they said, she was sure they knew where the bowl was, too. She would have done whatever was necessary to bring them to tell her. Pretending docility before them for a few hours would have been a deal easier than putting up with Matt Cawthon for the light knew how many days. "I could have been as acquiescent as they wanted," she thought irritably. "They'd have thought I was a pliable old slipper. I could have..." That was a lie, and it did not take a foul, remembered taste to convince her. Given half a chance, she would have shaken every one of those women till they told her what she wanted to know. She would have given them Aes Sedai till they squealed. She scowled sideways at Elaine. The other woman seemed lost in thought. Nynaeve wished she did not know what the other woman was thinking about. A wasted morning, and not far short of complete humiliation. She did not like being in the wrong. She was not yet used to admitting she was, really. And now she was going to have to apologize to Elaine. She truly hated apologizing. Well, it would be bad enough back in their rooms. With Birgitta and Avienda still out, it was to be hoped. She was not about to begin in the street, with who knew who streaming by. The throng had thickened, though the sun hardly seemed much higher through the wheeling clouds of seabirds that cried overhead. Finding their way was not easy, after all those twists and turns. Nynaeve had to ask directions half a dozen times, while Elaine stared in another direction, pretending indifference. She stalked across bridges, ducked around wagons and carts, jumped out of the way of racing sedan chairs that wove through the crowds, wished Elaine would say something. Nynaeve knew how to nurse a grudge, and the longer she herself kept silent, the worse it was when she spoke. So the longer Elaine walked without speaking, the darker became the image in her mind, of how it was going to be back in their rooms. That made her furious. She had admitted she was wrong, if only to herself. Elaine had no right to make her suffer this way. She began wearing such a face that even people who did not notice their rings gave them a clear path. People who did notice usually seemed to find an urgent need to be a street away. Even some sedan chair bearers skirted around her. "How old did Rihanna look to you?" Elaine asked suddenly. Nynaeve nearly jumped. They were almost back to Mulhara. 50 years, maybe 60. I don't see it matters. She ran her eyes over the crowd to see if anyone was close enough to hear. A passing hawker, her tray displaying a bitter little yellow fruit called a lemon, tried to swallow her cry in mid-shout when Nynaeve's gaze rested on her for a moment, with the result that she doubled over her tray, coughing and choking. Nynaeve sniffed. The woman probably had been eavesdropping, if not planning to cut a purse. "They are a guild, Elaine, and they do know where the bowl is. I just know they do." That was not what she had intended to say at all. If she apologized for dragging Elaine into this now, maybe it would not be so bad. "I suppose they are," Elaine said absently. "I suppose they might. How is it that she can have aged so?" Nynaeve stopped dead in the middle of the street. After all that arguing, after getting them thrown out, she supposed? "Well, I suppose she aged the same way as the rest of us, a day at a time. Elaine, if you believed, why did you announce who you were like Rhiannon at the tower?" She rather liked that. According to the story, what Queen Rhiannon got was far from what she had wanted. The question did not seem to register with Elaine, for all her education. She pulled Nynaeve to one side as a curtained green carriage rumbled past. The street was not very wide there. Over to the front of a seamstress's shop, with a wide doorway showing several dressmakers' forms clothed in half-done dresses. "They were not going to tell us anything, Nynaeve, not if you got down on your knees and begged." Nynaeve opened her mouth indignantly, then snapped it shut. She had never said anything about begging. Anyway, why should she have been the only one? Better any woman at all than Matt Cawthon. Elaine had a fly up her nose, though, and was not to be distracted. "Nynaeve, she must have slowed like everyone else. How old is she to look 50 or 60? "What are you talking about?" Without thinking, Nynaeve noted the location in a corner of her mind. The seamstress's work looked quite good, worth closer examination. "She probably doesn't channel any more than she can help, afraid as she is of being mistaken for a sister. She wouldn't have wanted her face too smooth, after all." "You never listened in class, did you?" Elaine murmured. She saw the plump seamstress beaming in the doorway, and drew Nynaeve toward the corner of the building. Considering the amount of lace the seamstress wore on her own dress, the bodice buried in it, and paces of it drooping over her exposed petticoats, she would bear close watching if Nynaeve did order anything. "Forget clothes for one moment, Nynaeve. Who is the oldest accepted you remember?" She gave Elaine a very level look. The woman made it sound as if she never thought of anything else. And she had too listened. Sometimes. "Ellen Worrell, I think. She's about my age, I think." Of course, the seamstress's own dress would look fine with a more modest neckline and much less lace. In green silk. Lan liked green, though she certainly was not going to choose her dresses for him. He liked blue as well. Elaine barked such a laugh that Nynaeve wondered whether she had spoken aloud. Coloring fiercely, she tried to explain. She was sure she could, by Belle Tyne, but the other woman gave her no opportunity for a word. "Ellen's sister came to visit her just before you first arrived at the tower, Nynaeve. Her younger sister. The woman had gray hair. Well, some of it was. She must have been over 40, Nynaeve." "Ellen Worrell was past 40? What are you saying, Elaine?" No one was close enough to listen, and no one seemed to be giving them a second glance, except the still hopeful seamstress, but Elaine lowered her voice to a whisper. "We slow, Nynaeve. Somewhere between 20 and 25 we begin aging more slowly. How much depends on how strong we are, but when doesn't. Any woman who can channel does it. Takima said she thought it was the beginning of achieving the ageless look, though I don't think anyone has ever reached that until they've worn the shawl at least a year or two, sometimes 5 or more. Think. You know any sister with gray hair is old, even if you aren't supposed to mention it. So if Rihanna slowed, and she must have, how old is she? Nynaeve did not care how old Rihanna was. She wanted to cry. No wonder everyone refused to believe her age. It explained why the women's circle back home had looked over her shoulder as if unsure she was old enough to be trusted fully. Achieving a sister's ageless face was all very well, but how long before she had her gray hairs? Blinking, she turned away angrily, and something struck her a glancing blow on the back of the head. Staggering, she rounded on Elaine in astonishment. Why had the woman hit her? Only Elaine lay in a heap, eyes closed and a nasty purple lump rising on her temple. Groggily, Nynaeve fell to her knees and gathered her friend into her arms. "Your friend must be taken ill," a long-nosed woman said, kneeling beside them, careless of a yellow dress that showed far too much bosom, even by Ebudari standards. "Let me help." A tall fellow, handsome in his embroidered silk vest except for a rather oily grin, bent to take Nynaeve's shoulders. "Here, I have a carriage. We'll take you somewhere more comfortable than a paving stone." "Go away," Nynaeve told them politely. "We don't need your help." The man kept trying to raise her to her feet, though, to guide her toward a red carriage, where a startled-appearing woman in blue beckoned vigorously. The long-nosed woman actually tried to lift Elaine, thanking the man for his help, and chattering how his carriage sounded a fine idea. A crowd of onlookers seemed to have gathered out of air in a semicircle, women murmuring sympathy about fainting from the heat, men offering to help carry the ladies. A scrawny fellow, bold as you please, reached for Nynaeve's purse almost right under her nose. Her head still swam enough to make embracing Sidar difficult, but if all those nattering folk had not fueled her temper, what she saw lying in the street would have. An arrow with a blunt stone head. The one that had grazed her, or the one that had struck Elaine. She channeled, and the scrawny cutpurse doubled over, clutching himself and squealing like a pig in briars. Another flow, and the long-nosed woman fell over backward with a shriek twice as high. The man in the silk vest apparently decided they did not need his help after all, because he turned and ran for the carriage, but she gave him a dose anyway. He out-bellowed any outraged bull, as the woman in the carriage hauled him in by his vest. "Thank you, but we don't need any help," Nynaeve shouted, politely. Few remained to hear. Once it became clear that the one power was being used, and folk suddenly leaping about and yelling for no visible cause made it clear enough to most, they hurried elsewhere. The long-nosed woman gathered herself up and actually jumped onto the back of the red carriage, clinging precariously as the dark-vested driver whipped the horses away through the crowd, people leaping aside. Even the cutpurse hobbled off as fast as he could. Nynaeve could not have cared less had the earth opened and swallowed the whole lot. Chest aching, she ran fine flows of wind and water, earth, fire, and spirit mixed and blended through Elaine. It was a simple weave, no bother despite her faint dizziness, and the result let her breathe again. The bruise was not serious. The bones of Elaine's skull were unbroken. Normally she would have redirected those same flows into much more complex weaves, the healing she had discovered herself. At the moment, simpler weaves were all she could manage, though. With just spirit, wind, and water, she wove the healing that Yellows had used since time immemorial. Elaine's eyes shot open wide, and with a gasp that seemed to take all the air in her, she convulsed like a netted trout, slippered heels drumming on the pavement. That only lasted a moment, of course, but in that moment the bruise shrank and vanished. Nynaeve helped her to her feet, and a woman's hand appeared, holding a pewter cup full of water. "Even an Aes Sedai might be thirsty after that," the seamstress said. Elaine reached for it, but Nynaeve laid fingers on her wrist. "No, thank you." The woman shrugged, and as she turned away, Nynaeve added in a different tone, "Thank you." It seemed to come easier the more you said it. She was not sure she liked that. That ocean of lace heaved as the seamstress shrugged again. "I make dresses for anyone. I can do better for your coloring than that." She vanished back into her shop. Nynaeve frowned after her. "What happened?" Elaine demanded. "Why wouldn't you let me take a drink?"
I'm thirsty and hungry.
With a last frown for the seamstress, Nynaeve bent to pick up the arrow. The other woman needed no explanations. Saidar shone around her in a flash.
Teslin and Jolene?
Nynaeve shook her head. The slight wooziness seemed to be fading. She did not think those two would stoop to this. She did not think so.
What about Rihanna? She said quietly.
The seamstress was back in the doorway, still hopeful. She might want to make sure we leave. Or worse, maybe Garinia. That was almost as chilling as Teslin and Jolene, and twice as infuriating. Somehow Elaine managed to look pretty while scowling. Whoever it was, we will settle them. You'll see. The scowl faded.
Nynaeve, if the circle does know where the bowl is, we can find it, but...
She bit her lip, hesitating. I only know one way to be sure. Nynaeve nodded slowly, though she would rather have eaten a handful of dirt. Today had seemed so bright for a time, but then it had spiraled into darkness, from Rihanna to...
Oh, light! How long before she had her gray hair?
Don't cry, Nynaeve. Matt can't possibly be that bad. He'll find it for us in a few days, I know. Nynaeve only cried harder. Chapter 25 Mind Trap. Mogedion did not want to dream the dream again, but wanting to wake, wanting to scream, did no good. Sleep held her faster than any manacles. The beginning went by quickly, a sketchy blur. No mercy, she would have to relive the rest that much sooner. She barely recognized the woman who entered the tent where she was held prisoner. Halima, secretary to one of these fools who called themselves Aes Sedai. Fools, yet they held her tightly enough by the band of silver metal around her neck, held her and made her obey. Fast movement, though she prayed for slowness. The woman channeled to make a light, and Mogedion saw only the light. It had to be Sidene. Among the living, only the Chosen knew how to tap the true power, the power that came from the Dark One. And few were fool enough to, except in direst need. But that was impossible. Blurring quickness. The woman named herself Arangar, and called Mogedion by name. She gave summons to the Pit of Doom, and removed the Eidam necklace, flinching at pain no woman should have felt. Again, how many times had she done this? Again Mogedion wove a small gateway in the tent. She skimmed to give herself time to think in the endless dark, but no sooner did she step onto her platform, like a small enclosed marble balcony complete with a comfortable chair, than she arrived on the black slopes of Sheol Ghul, forever shrouded in twilight, where vents and tunnels emitted steam and smoke and harsh vapors, and a Murdral came to her in its dead-black garb, like a slug-white eyeless man, but taller, more massive than any other half-man. It regarded her arrogantly, and gave its odd name unbidden, and commanded her to come. These were not things Murdral did with the Chosen. Now she screamed in the depths of her mind for the dream to move faster, to blur beyond seeing, beyond knowing. But now, as she followed Shaidar Haran's back into the entrance to the Pit of Doom, now all flowed at its normal pace, and seemed more real than Telairan Riad or the waking world. Tears leaked from Mogedion's eyes, down cheeks that already glistened. She twitched on her hard palate, arms and legs jerking as she fought desperately, futilely, to wake. She was no longer aware that she dreamed. All seemed real. But deep memories remained, and in those depths instinct shrieked and clawed for escape. She was well familiar with the sloping tunnels ceilinged in stone daggers like fangs, the walls glowing with pale light. Many times she had made this downward journey since the day so long ago when she first came to make obeisance to the great lord and pledge her soul, but never as now, never with her failure known in all its magnitude. Always before she had managed to hide failures even from the great lord, many times. Things could be done here that could be done nowhere else. Things could happen here that could happen nowhere else. She gave a start as one of the stone fangs brushed her hair, then gathered herself as best she could. Those spikes and blades still cleared the strange, too-tall Murdral easily, but though it overtopped her by head and shoulders and more, she was forced to move her head around their points now. Reality was clay to the great lord here, and he often made his displeasure known so. A stone tooth struck her shoulder, and she ducked to go under another. There was no longer enough height in the tunnel for her to straighten as she walked. She bent lower, scurrying, crouched in the Murdral's wake, trying to get closer. Its stride never changed, but no matter how quickly she scuttled, the interval between them did not lessen. The ceiling descending, the great lord's fangs to rend traitors and fools, and Mogedion dropped to hands and knees, crawling, then flattened to elbows and knees. Light flared and flickered in the tunnel, cast from the entrance to the pit itself just ahead, and Mogedion slithered on her belly, pulled herself along with her hands, pushed with her feet. Stone points dug at her flesh, caught at her dress. Panting, she wriggled the last distance to the sound of ripping wool. Staring back over her shoulder, she shivered convulsively. Where the tunnel mouth should have been stood a smooth stone wall. Perhaps the great lord had timed it all exactly, and perhaps had she been slower. The ledge on which she lay projected above a black mottled red lake of molten rock, where flames the size of men danced and died and reappeared. Overhead the cavern rose roofless through the mountain to a sky where wild clouds raced, striated red and yellow and black, as if on the winds of time themselves. It was not the dark clouded sky seen outside on Sheol Ghul. None of that earned a second glance, and not just because she had seen it many times. The bore into the great lord's place of imprisonment was no closer here than anywhere else in the world, but here she could feel it. Here she could bathe in the radiant glory of the great lord. The true power washed around her, so strong here that attempting to channel it would fry her to a cinder. Not that she had any desire to pay the price elsewhere, either. She started to push up to her knees, and something struck her between the shoulder blades, driving her down hard onto the stone ledge, crushing the air from her lungs. Stunned, she struggled for breath, then stared back up over her shoulder. The Murdral stood with one massive boot planted firmly on her back. Almost she embraced Sidar, though channeling here without express permission was a good way to die. The arrogance on the slopes above was one thing. But this... "Do you know who I am?" she demanded. "I am Mogedion." That eyeless gaze watched her as it might an insect. She had often seen Murdral look at ordinary humans that way.
"Mogedion!"
That voice inside her head flushed away all thought of the Murdral. It nearly flushed away all thought. Beside this, any human lover's deepest embrace was a drop of water beside the ocean.
"How deep is your failure, Mogedion? The chosen are always the strongest, but you let yourself be captured. You taught those who would oppose me, Mogedion."
Eyelids fluttering, she fought for coherence.
"Great lord, I taught them only small things, and I fought them as I could. I taught them a supposed way to detect a man channeling," she managed to laugh. "Practicing it gives them such headaches they cannot channel for hours."
Silence. Perhaps as well. They had given up trying to learn that long before her rescue, but the great lord did not need to know that.
"Great lord, you know how I have served you. I serve in the shadows, and your enemies never feel my bite until my venom is working."
She did not quite dare say she had deliberately let herself be captured to work from within, but she could suggest.
"Great lord, you know how many of your enemies I brought down in the War of Power. From the shadows, unseen, or if seen, ignored, because I could not possibly be a threat."
Silence. And then,
"My chosen are always the strongest. My hand moves."
That voice reverberating in her skull turned her bones to boiling honey and her brain to fire.
The Murdral had her chin in its hand, forcing her head up before her vision cleared enough to see the knife in its other hand. All her dreams were to end here in a slit throat, her body going to feed the Trollocs. Perhaps Shidar Haran would save a choice cut for itself. Perhaps...
No. She knew she was going to die, but this Murdral would not eat one shred of her. She reached to embrace Sidar, and her eyes bulged. There was nothing there. Nothing. It was as if she had been severed. She knew she had not. It was said that tearing was the deepest pain anyone could know, beyond any power to deaden. But in those stunned moments, the Murdral forced her mouth open, scraped the blade along her tongue, then nicked her ear. And as it straightened with her blood and saliva, she knew, even before it produced what appeared to be a tiny, fragile cage of gold wire and crystal. Some things could only be done here, some only to those who could channel, and she had brought a number of men and women for this very purpose.
No,
she breathed. Her eyes could not leave the Cor Suvra.
No, not me. Not me!
Ignoring her, Shaidar Haran scraped the fluids from the knife onto the Cor Suvra. The crystal turned a milky pink, the first setting. With a flick of its wrist, it tossed the mine trap out over the lake of molten stone for the second. The golden crystal cage arched through the air and suddenly stopped, floating at the very spot where it seemed the boar was, the place where the pattern lay thinnest of all. Mogedion forgot the Murdral. She flung out her hands toward the boar.
Mercy, great lord!
She had never noticed that the great lord of the dark possessed any mercy, but had she been bound in a cell with rabid wolves, or with a Darath in molt, she would have begged the same. In the right circumstances, you begged even for the impossible. The Cor Suvra hung in mid-air, turning slowly, glittering in the light of leaping fires below.
I have served you with all my heart, great lord. I beg mercy. I beg mercy.
You may serve me still.
The voice flung her into ecstasy beyond knowing, but at the same instant the sparkling mind-trap suddenly glowed like the sun, and in the midst of rapture she knew pain as if she had been immersed in the fiery lake. They blended and she howled, thrashing like a mad thing, thrashing in endless pain, endless, until after ages, after nothing remained but agony and the memory of agony, the tiny mercy of darkness overwhelmed her. Mogedion stirred on the pallet. Not again, please. She barely recognized the woman who entered the tent where she was held prisoner.
Please,
she shrieked in the depths of her mind. The woman channeled to make a light, and Mogedion saw only the light. Deep in sleep she quivered, vibrating from head to toe.
Please!
The woman named herself Arangar, and called Mogedion by name. She gave summons to the pit of doom, and—
Wake, woman,
said a voice like rotted bone crumbling, and Mogedion's eyes popped open. She almost wished for the dream back. No door or window broke the featureless stone walls of her small prison, and there were no glow bulbs or even lamps, but light came from somewhere. She did not know how many days she had been there, only that tasteless food appeared at irregular intervals, that the single bucket serving for sanitation was emptied at even more irregular times, and soap and a bucket of perfumed water were somehow left for her to clean herself. She was not sure whether that was a mercy or not. The glad thrill at seeing a bucket of water reminded her how far she had fallen. Shaidar Haran was in the cell with her now. Hurriedly rolling from her pallet, she knelt and put her face to the bare stone floor. She had always done whatever was necessary for survival, and the Murdral had been all too glad to teach her what was necessary.
I greet you eagerly, Miakova.
The lashed-together title burned on her tongue. One who owns me, it meant, or simply, my owner. The strange shield Shaidar Haran had used on her, Murdral could not, but it did. The shield was not in evidence, yet she did not consider channeling. The true power was denied her, of course. That could be drawn only with the great lord's blessing. But the source tantalized, though the glow just beyond sight seemed somehow odd. She still did not consider it. Every time the Murdral visited, it displayed her mind-trap. Channeling too near your own Cor Suvra was extremely painful.
The nearer, the more the pain. This close, she did not think she would survive a simple touch on the source. And that was the least of the mind trap's dangers. Shaidar Haran chuckled, a rasp of dried, cracked leather. That was another difference about this Murdral. Far more cruel than Trollocs, who were merely bloodthirsty, Murdral were cold and dispassionate in it. Shaidar Haran often showed amusement, though. So far she felt lucky to have only bruises. Most women would have been on the brink of madness by now, if not beyond.
"And are you eager to obey?"
that rustling, grating voice asked. "Yes, I am eager to obey, Miekova." Whatever was necessary to survive. But she still gasped when cold fingers suddenly tangled in her hair. She scrambled to her feet on her own as much as possible, but still was hauled up. At least this time her feet remained on the floor. The Murdral studied her, expressionless. Remembering past visits, it required an effort not to flinch or scream, or simply reach for Sidar and make an end.
"Close your eyes," it told her, "and keep them closed until you are commanded to open them."
Mogedion's eyes snapped shut. One of Shaidar Haran's lessons had been instant obedience. Besides, with her eyes closed, she could try to pretend that she was somewhere else. Whatever was necessary. Abruptly, the hand in her hair rushed her forward, and she screamed in spite of herself. The Murdral meant to run her into the wall. Her hands went up for protection, and Shaidar Haran released her. She staggered at least 10 steps, but her cell was not 10 paces, corner to corner. Wood smoke. She smelled a faint touch of wood smoke. She kept her eyelids firmly closed, though. She meant to continue with no more than bruises, and as few bruises as possible, for as long as she could manage.
"You can look now," a deep voice said.
She did, cautiously. The speaker was a tall, broad-shouldered young man in black boots and breeches and a flowing white shirt unlaced at the top, who watched her with startlingly blue eyes from a deep, cushioned armchair in front of a marble fireplace, where flames danced along long logs. She stood in a wood-paneled room that might have belonged to a wealthy merchant or noble of moderate rank in this time, the furniture lightly carved and touched with gilt, the rugs woven in red and gold arabesques. She did not doubt it was somewhere close by Sheol Ghul, though. It did not have the feel of Tel Iron Riod, the only other possibility. Swiveling her head hastily, she drew a deep breath. The Murdral was nowhere to be seen. Tight bands of Kwande seemed to vanish from around her chest.
"Did you enjoy your time in the vacuole?"
Mogedion felt icy fingers dig into her scalp. She was no researcher or maker, but she knew that word. She did not even think to ask how a young man of this time did, too. Sometimes there were bubbles in the pattern, though someone like Masana would say that was too simple an explanation. Vacuoles could be entered if you knew how, and manipulated much like the rest of the world. Researchers had often done great experiments in vacuoles, so she vaguely remembered hearing. But they were outside the pattern, really, and sometimes they closed up, or perhaps broke off and drifted away. Even Masana could not say what happened, except that anything in them at the time was gone forever.
"How long?"
She was surprised her voice was so steady. She rounded on the young man who sat there showing her white teeth.
"I said how long? Or don't you know?"
"I saw you arrive."
He paused, lifting a silver goblet from the table beside his chair, eyes smiling at her over the rim as he drank.
"The night before last."
She could not hide a relieved gasp. The only reason anyone would want to enter a vacuole was that time flowed differently there, sometimes slower, sometimes faster, sometimes much faster. She would not have been entirely surprised to learn that the great lord had really imprisoned her for 100 years, or 1,000, to emerge into a world already his, to make her way feeding among carrion, while the other chosen stood at the pinnacle. She was still one of the chosen, in her own mind at least, until the great lord himself said she was not. She had never heard of anyone being released once a mind trap was set, but she would find a way. There was always a way for those who were cautious, while those fell who called caution cowardice. She herself had carried a few of that so-called brave sort to Shale Ghoul to be fitted with Corsuvra. Suddenly it occurred to her that this fellow knew a great deal for a friend of the dark, especially one not many years past 20. He swung one leg over an arm of the chair, lounging insolently under her scrutiny. Grendahl might have snatched him, if he had any position or power. Only too strong a chin kept him from being pretty enough. She did not think she had ever seen eyes so blue. With his insolence in her very face and what she had had to endure at Shaidar Haran's hand so fresh, with the source calling her and the Murdral gone, she considered teaching this young friend of the dark a sharp lesson. The fact that her clothes were grimy added their part. She herself smelled faintly of the perfume in the wash water, but she had had no way to clean the rough woolen dress in which she fled Egwene Alvear, with its rips from her journey down to the pit. Prudence prevailed. This room must be close to Shale Ghoul, but barely. "What is your name?" she demanded. "Do you have any idea who you are speaking to?"
"Yes, I do, Mogedion. You may call me Moradin."
Mogedion gasped. Not for the name, any fool could call himself Death, but a tiny black fleck, just large enough to see, floated straight across one of those blue eyes and then across the other in the same line. This Moradin had tapped into the true power, and more than once, much more. She knew that some men who could channel survived in this time aside from Althor. This fellow was much of a size with Althor, but she had not expected the great lord to allow one that particular honor. An honor with a bite, as any of the chosen knew. In the long run, the true power was far more addictive than the one power. A strong will could hold down the desire to draw more Sidar or Sidene, but she herself did not believe the will existed strong enough to resist the true power, not once the Sa appeared in your eyes. The final price was different, but no less terrible.
"You have been given distinction greater than you know," she told him.
As though her filthy dress was the finest strife, she took the armchair opposite him. "Bring me some of that wine, and I will tell you. Only 29 others have ever been granted." To her shock, he laughed.
"You misapprehend, Mogedion. You still serve the great lord, but not quite as you once did. The time for playing your own games has passed. If you had not managed to do some good by accident, you would be dead now."
"I am one of the chosen, boy," she said, fury burning through caution. She sat up straight, facing him with all the knowledge of an age that made his little different from times of mud huts. As much of that knowledge as she had, anyway, and in some areas, concerning the one power, no one outstripped her. She almost embraced the source, no matter how close Shale Ghoul lay. "Your mother probably used my name to frighten you not so many years gone. But know that grown men who could crumple you like a rag sweated when they heard it. You will watch your tongue with me."
He reached into the open neck of his shirt, and her own tongue clove to the roof of her mouth, her eyes fixed on the small cage of gold wire and blood-red crystal that he drew out, dangling on a cord. She thought vaguely that he tucked another just like it back in, but she had eyes only for her own. It definitely was hers. His thumb stroked, and she felt that caress across her mind, her soul. Breaking a mind trap did not require much more pressure than he was using. She could be on the other side of the world or farther, and it would not matter a hair. The part of her that was her would be separated. She would still see with her eyes and hear with her ears, taste what crossed her tongue and feel what touched her, but helpless within an automaton that was utterly obedient to whoever held the Corsuvra. Whether or not there was any way to get free of it, a mind-trap was just what its name implied. She could feel the blood draining from her face.
"You understand now?" he said. "You still serve the great lord, but now it will be by doing as I say."
"I understand, Miakova," she said automatically.
Again he laughed, a deep, rich sound that mocked her as he put the mind-trap away beneath his shirt.
"There is no need for that, now you've had your lesson. I will call you Mogedion,
and you will call me Moradin. You are still one of the Chosen. Who is there to replace you?
Yes, of course, Moradrin, she said tonelessly.
Whatever he said, she knew that she was owned.
Chapter 26 The Irrevocable Words. Morghese lay awake, staring at the ceiling through the moonlit darkness, and tried to think of her daughter. A single pale linen sheet covered her, but despite the heat she sweated in a thick woolen sleeping gown, laced tightly to the neck. Sweat hardly mattered. No matter how many times she bathed, no matter how hot the water, she did not feel clean. Elaine must be safe in the White Tower. At times it seemed years since she could make herself trust Aes Sedai, yet whatever the paradox, the tower was surely the safest place for Elaine. She tried to think of Gawain. He would be in Tar-Valon with his sister, full of his pride for her, so earnest in his desire to be her shield when she needed one. And of Galad. Why would they not let her see him? She loved him as much as if he had come out of her own body, and in so many ways he needed it more than the other two. She tried to think of them. It was difficult to think of anything except... Wide eyes stared up into the darkness, glistening with unshed tears. She had always thought she was brave enough to do whatever needed doing, to face whatever came. She had always believed she could pick herself up and continue to fight. In one endless hour, without leaving more than a few bruises that were already fading, Radam Asunawa had begun teaching her differently. Eamon Valda had completed her education with one question. The bruise her answer had left on her heart had not faded. She should have gone back to Asunawa herself and told him to do his worst. She should have... She prayed that Elaine was safe. Perhaps it was not fair to hope more for Elaine than for Galad or Gawain, but Elaine would be the next Queen of Andor. The tower would not miss the chance to put an Aes Sedai on the Lion Throne. If only she could see Elaine, see all her children once more. Something rustled in the dark bedchamber, and she held her breath, fought against trembling. The faint moonlight barely let her make out the bedposts. Valda had ridden north from Amador yesterday, him and Asunawa, with thousands of white cloaks to face the prophet. But if he had come back, if he... A shape in the darkness resolved into a woman, too short for Linny. "I thought you might still be awake," Brianna's voice said softly. "Drink this. It will help." The Kyrianan woman tried to put a silvery cup into Morghese's hand. It gave off a slightly sour smell. "Wait until you're summoned to bring me drink," she snapped, pushing the cup away. Warm liquid spilled onto her hand, onto the linen sheet. "I was almost asleep when you came stamping in," she lied. "Leave me." Instead of obeying, the woman stood looking down at her, face shadowed. Morghese did not like Brianna Taborwin. Whether Brianna truly was nobly born and come down in the world, as she sometimes claimed, or merely a servant who had learned to counterfeit her betters, she obeyed when and as she chose, and let her tongue run entirely too free, as she proved now. "You moan like a sheep," Morghese trakand. Even kept low, her voice seethed in anger. She set the cup on the small bedside table with a thump. More of the contents splashed onto the tabletop. "Bah! Many others have seen far worse. You are alive. None of your bones are broken. Your wits are whole. Endure. Let the past pass, and go on with your life. You have been so much on edge that the men walk on their toes, even Master Gil. Lamgwyn has hardly slept a wink these 3 nights." Morghese flushed with annoyance. Even in Andor, servants did not speak so. She caught the woman's arm in a tight grip, but anxiety warred with displeasure. "They don't know, do they?" "If they did, they would try to avenge her, rescue her. They would die. Tullanvor would die." "Linny and I draped linen over their eyes for you," Brianna sneered, pulling her hand away and flinging it back at her. "If I could save Lamgwyn, I would let them know you for the bleating sheep you are. He sees the light made flesh in you. I see a woman without courage to accept the day. I will not let you destroy him with your cowardice."
"Cowardice?"
Outrage welled up in Morgay's, yet no words came. Her fingers knotted in the sheet. She did not think she could have decided in cold blood to lie with Valda, but had she could have lived with it. She thought she could. Another matter entirely to say yes because she feared facing Asunawa's knotted cords and needles again, feared worse that he would have gotten to eventually. However she had screamed under Asunawa's ministrations, Valda was the one who had showed her the true borders of her courage, so far short of where she had believed. Valda's touch, his bed, could be forgotten with time, but she would never be able to wash the shame of that yes from her lips. Brianna hurled the truth in her face, and she did not know how to reply. She was spared the need by a rush of boots in the outer room. The bedchamber door flung open, and a running man stopped a pace inside.
"So you're awake?"
"Good," Talonvor's voice said after a moment, which allowed her heart to start beating again, allowed her to breathe. She tried to release Brianna's hand. She did not remember clasping it, but to her surprise the woman squeezed once before letting go. "Something is happening," Talonvor went on, striding to the lone window. Standing to one side as if to avoid being seen, he peered into the night. Moonlight outlined his tall form.
"Master Gil, come and tell what you saw."
A head appeared in the doorway, bald top shining in the darkness. Behind, in the other room, a hulking shadow moved. Lamgwyn Dorn. When Basil Gil realized she was still in bed, that faint shining from his scalp jerked as he directed his eyes elsewhere, though he probably had difficulty making out more than the bed itself. Master Gil was even wider than Lamgwyn, but not nearly as tall.
"Forgive me, my queen. I didn't mean to—"
He cleared his throat violently, and his boots scraped on the floor, shifting. Had he had a cap, he would have been turning it in his hands, or wadding it nervously.
"I was in the long corridor on my way to
the Jakes," was what he could not bring himself to say to her.
"Anyway, I glanced out one of the windows, and I saw a big bird, I think, land on top of the south barracks."
"A bird?"
Linny's thin voice drove Master Gil to leap into the room, clearing the doorway. Or maybe it was a sharp poke in his stout ribs. Linny usually took every advantage her gray hair offered. She stalked by him, still belting her nightrobe.
"Fools! Ox-brained lummoxes! You woke my ch—"
She stopped with a fierce cough. Linny never forgot that she had been Morgaze's nurse, and her mother's as well, but she never slipped in front of others. She would be cross that she had now, and it showed in her voice.
"You woke your queen for a bird?"
Patting her hairnet, she automatically tucked in a few strands that had escaped in her sleep.
"Have you been drinking, Basil Gil?"
Morgaze wondered that herself.
"I didn't know it was a bird," Master Gil protested. "It didn't look like any bird, but what else flies except bats? It was big. Men climbed off its back, and there was another still on its neck when it took off again. While I was slapping my face to wake up, another of the things landed, and more men climbed down, and then another came, and I decided it was time to tell Lord Talonvor."
Linny did not sniff, but Morgaze could almost feel her stare, and it was not directed at her. The man who had abandoned his inn to follow her certainly felt it.
"The light's own truth, my queen," he insisted.
"Light," Talonvor announced like an echo.
Something just landed atop the north barracks."
Morgaze had never heard him sound shaken before. All she wanted was to make them all go away and leave her alone in her misery, but there seemed no hope. Talonvor was worse than Brianna in many ways, much worse. "My robe," she said, and for once Brianna was quick to hand her one. Master Gil hastily turned his face to the wall while she climbed from the bed and put on the silk robe. She strode to the window, tying the sash. The long north barracks loomed across the wide courtyard, four hulking floors of flat-roofed dark stone. Not a light showed, there or anywhere in the fortress. All was stillness and silence.
"I see nothing, Talonvor."
He drew her back,
Just watch, he said.
Another time she would have regretted his hand leaving her shoulder and been irritated at her own regret as well as his tone. Now, after Valda, she felt relief, and irritation at the relief as well as his tone. He was too disrespectful by miles, far too stubborn, too young, not much older than Galad. Shadows moved as the moon did, but nothing else stirred. Off in the city of Amador a dog bayed, answered by more. Then, as she opened her mouth to dismiss Talonvor and all of them, darkness atop the massive barracks humped up and hurled itself off the roof. Something, Talonvor had called it, and she had no better name. An impression of a long body that seemed thicker than a man was tall, great ribbed wings like a bat sweeping down as the creature fell toward the courtyard. A figure, a man, sitting just behind a sinuous neck. And then the wings caught air, and the something soared up, blocking the moonlight as it swept over her head, trailing a long, thin tail. Morgaze closed her mouth slowly. The only thought that came to her was Shadow Spawn. Trollocs and Murdral were not the only shadow-twisted creatures in the Blight. She had never been taught of anything like this, but her tutors in the tower said that things lived there no one had ever seen clearly, and lived to describe. How could it be so far south, though? Abruptly a flash of light flared with a great boom in the direction of the main gates, and then again, at two more places along the great outer wall. Those were gates, too, she believed. What in the pit of doom was that? Talonvor muttered in a moment of silence, before alarm gongs began resounding in the darkness. Shouts rose, and screams, and hoarse cries like some sort of horn. Fire leaped with a crash of thunder, then again elsewhere.
The One Power, Morgaze breathed.
She might not be able to channel, or as well as not, but she could tell that. Notions of Shadow Spawn fled.
It must be Aes Sedai.
She heard someone's breath catch behind her, Linny or Brianna. Basil Gill excitedly murmured, Aes Sedai, and Lamgwyn murmured back too low for her to understand. Off in the darkness, metal clashed on metal, fire bellowed, and lightning streaked from the cloudless sky. Faintly through the din came alarm bells from the city at last, but strangely few.
Aes Sedai? Talonvor sounded doubtful.
Why now? To rescue you, Morgaze? I thought they couldn't use the power against men, only Shadow Spawn. Besides, if that winged creature wasn't Shadow Spawn, I will never see one.
You don't know what you are talking about, she said, confronting him heatedly. You...
A crossbow bolt clashed against the window frame in a spray of stone chips. Air stirred against her face as it ricocheted between them and planted itself in one of the bedposts with a solid chunk. A few inches to the right, and all her troubles would have been ended. She did not move, but Talonvor pulled her away from the window with an oath. Even by moonlight she could see his frown as he studied her. For a moment she thought he might touch her face. If he did, she did not know whether she would weep or scream or order him to leave her forever or... Instead, he said,
"More likely it's some of those men, those shaman or whatever they call themselves."
He insisted on accepting the strange, impossible tales that had seeped even into the fortress.
"I think I can get you out right now. Everything will be confusion. Come with me."
She did not correct him. Few people knew anything about the One Power, much less the differences between Sidar and Sidine. His idea had its attractions. They might be able to escape in the bedlam of a battle.
"Take her out into that?" Linny screeched.
Flaring lights drowned the moon at the window. Crashes and thunders drowned the din of men and swords.
"I thought you had more wits, Martin Talonvor. Only fools kiss hornets or bite fire. You heard her say it's Aes Sedai. Do you think she doesn't know? Do you?"
"My lord, if it is Aes Sedai..."
Master Gill trailed off. Talonvor's hands fell away from her, and he grumbled under his breath, wishing he had a sword. Pedro Nile had allowed him to keep his blade. Aemon Valda was not so trusting. For an instant, disappointment swelled in her breast. If only he had insisted, had dragged her. What was the matter with her? Had he tried to drag her anywhere for any reason, she would have had his hide. She needed to take hold of herself. Valda had dented her confidence. No, he had casually ripped it to shreds, but she must cling to those shreds and knit them up again, somehow, if the tatters were worth knitting up again.
"At least I can find out what is happening," Talonvor growled, striding for the door. "If it isn't your eyes, Sedai—"
"No. You will remain here. Please." She was very glad of the pale darkness, hiding her furiously flushing face. She would have bitten her tongue off before saying that last word, but it had slipped out before she knew. She went on in firmer tones. "You will remain here, guarding your queen as you should." In the dim light she could see his face, and his bow seemed quite proper, but she would have wagered her last copper both were angry.
"I will be in your anteroom."
Well, there was no doubt about his voice. For once, though, she cared neither how angry he was nor how little he hid it. Very possibly she might kill the infuriating man with her own hands, but he was not going to die tonight, cut down by soldiers, with no way to tell which side he was on. There was no hope of sleep now, even had she been able. Without lighting any lamps, she washed her face and teeth. Brianna and Lini helped her dress, in blue silk slashed with green, with spills of snowy lace at her wrists and beneath her chin. It would do very well for receiving Aes Sedai. Sidar raged in the night. They had to be Aes Sedai. Who else could it be? When she joined the men in the anteroom, they were sitting in darkness except for the moonlight through the windows and the occasional flash of power-wrought fire. Even a candle might attract unwanted attention. Lamgwin and Master Gil sprang from their chairs respectfully. Talonvor stood more slowly, and she needed no light to know he regarded her with a sullen frown. Furious that she had to ignore him, she was his queen. Furious and barely able to keep it from her voice, she ordered Lamgwin to bring more of the tall wooden chairs further from the windows. In silence they sat and waited. At least silence on their part. Outside, thunderous crashes and roars still echoed. Horns cried and men shouted, and through it she felt Sidar surge and fall and surge again. Slowly, after at least an hour, the battle dwindled and died. Voices still shouted incomprehensible orders, wounded screamed, and sometimes those strange hoarse horns gave voice, but no more did steel ring on steel. Sidar faded. She was sure women still held it inside the fortress, but she did not think any channeled now. All seemed close to peaceful after the clamor and commotion. Talonvor stirred, but she waved him back before he could rise. For a moment she thought he would not obey. Night weakened, and sunlight crept in through the windows, shining on Talonvor's glower. She held her hands still in her lap. Patience was but one of the virtues that young man needed to learn. Patience stood second only to courage as a noble virtue. The sun rose higher. Lini and Brianna began whispering together in increasingly worried tones, shooting glances in her direction. Talonvor scowled, dark eyes smoldering, sitting rigid in that dark blue coat that fit him so well. Master Gil fidgeted, running first one hand then the other across his gray-fringed head, mopping his pink cheeks with a handkerchief. Lamgwin slouched in his chair, the one-time street-tough's heavy-lidded eyes making him seem half asleep, but whenever he glanced at Brianna, a smile flickered on his scarred, broken-nosed face. Morgaze focused on her breathing, almost like the exercises she had done during her months in the tower. Patience. If someone did not come soon, she was going to have sharp words to say, Aes Sedai or not. Despite herself, she jumped at an abrupt pounding on the door to the hallway. Before she could tell Brianna to see who was there, the door swung open, banging against the wall. Morgaze stared at who entered. A tall, dark, hook-nosed man stared back at her coldly, the long hilt of a sword rising above his shoulder. Strange armor covered his chest, overlapping plates lacquered glistening gold and black, and he held a helmet on his hip
that looked like an insect's head, black and gold and green, with three long, thin green plumes. Two more armored like him came at his heels, wearing their helmets, though without plumes. Their armor seemed painted rather than lacquered, and they carried crossbows ready. Still more stood in the hall outside, with gold and black tasseled spears. Talonvor and Lamgwin and even stout Master Gil scrambled to their feet, placing themselves between her and her peculiar visitors. She had to push a way through. The hook-nosed man's eyes went straight to her before she could demand an explanation.
"You are Morghaes, Queen of Andor."
His voice was harsh, and he drawled his words so badly she barely understood. He stepped on her reply.
"You will come with me, alone,"
he added, as Talonvor and Lamgwin and Master Gil all moved forward. The crossbowmen presented their weapons. The heavy quarrels looked made to punch holes in armor. A man would hardly slow one down. "I have no objection to my people remaining here until I return," she said a good deal more calmly than she felt. Who were these people? She was familiar with the accents of every nation, familiar with their armor. "I am sure you will see to my safety very well, Captain." He did not supply a name, only motioned curtly for her to follow. To her vast relief, Talonvor made no fuss, despite his hot gaze. To her vast irritation, Master Gil and Lamgwin looked to him before stepping back. In the hallway, the soldiers formed around her, the hook-nosed officer and the two crossbowmen in the lead. A guard of honor, she tried to tell herself. This soon after a battle, wandering around unprotected was worse than foolish. There might be holdouts who would seize a hostage, or kill any who saw them. She wished she believed that. She tried questioning the officer, but he never spoke a word, never slackened his stride or turned his head, and she stopped trying. None of the soldiers so much as glanced at her. They were hard-eyed men of the kind she knew from her own queen's guards, men who had seen fighting before, more than once. But who were they? Their boots struck the floorstones as one in an ominous drumbeat emphasized by the stark fortress corridors. There was little color, nothing for beauty except scattered tapestries showing white cloaks in bloody battle. She realized they were taking her toward the Lord Captain Commander's quarters, and a queasiness settled in the pit of her stomach. She had grown almost pleasantly accustomed to the way while Pedro Nile lived. She had come to dread it in the few days since he died. But as they rounded a corner, she started at the sight of some 24 archers marching behind their own officer, men in baggy trousers and boiled leather breastplates painted in horizontal stripes of blue and black. Each man wore a conical steel cap, with a veil of gray steel mail covering his face to the eyes. Here and there the ends of mustaches dangled below the veils. The archer's officer bowed to the one leading her guard, who merely raised his hand in reply. Tarabonners! She had not seen a Tarabonner soldier in a good many years, but those men were Tarabonners in spite of those stripes, or she would eat her slippers. Yet that made no sense. Tarabon was chaos come to life, a hundred-sided civil war between pretenders to the throne and dragonsworn. Tarabon could never have launched this attack on Amador itself. Unless, incredibly, one claimant had won out over the rest, and over the dragonsworn, and... It was impossible, and it did not explain these strangely armored soldiers, or that winged beast, or... She thought she had seen strangeness. She thought she had known queasiness. Then she and her guard turned another corner and encountered two women. One was slender, short as any Kyrianan and darker than any Tyran, in a blue dress that stopped well short of her ankles. Silver lightning forked across red panels on her breast and the sides of her wide, divided skirts. The other woman, in drab, dark gray, stood taller than most men, with golden hair to her shoulders that had been brushed till it glistened, and frightened green eyes. A silver leash connected a silver bracelet on the shorter woman's wrist to a necklace worn by the taller. They stood aside for Morghaes's guard, and when the hook-nosed officer murmured, "Der Soldam," Morghaes thought that was it. His slurred accent made understanding difficult.
When he murmured in tones nearly but not quite to an equal, the dark woman bowed her head slightly, twitched at the leash, and the golden-haired woman sank to the floor, folding herself with her head on her knees and her palms flat on the floor-stones. As Morgaze and her guards passed by, the dark woman bent to pat the other fondly on the head, as she might a dog, and worse, the kneeling woman looked up with pleasure and gratitude. Morgaze made the necessary effort to keep walking, to keep her knees from folding, to keep her stomach from emptying itself. The sheer servility was bad enough, but she was certain the woman being patted on the head could channel. Impossible. She walked in a daze, wondering whether this could be a dream, a nightmare, praying that it was. She had a vague awareness of stopping for more soldiers, these in red and black armor. Then... Pedro Niles' audience chamber, Valda's now, or rather whoever had taken the fortress, was changed. The great golden sunburst remained, set in the floor. But all Niles' captured banners, which Valda had kept as if they were his, were gone, and so were the furnishings, except for the plainly carved high-backed chair Niall and then Valda had used, flanked now by two tall, luridly painted screens. One showed a white-crested black bird of prey with a cruel beak, its white-tipped wings spread wide. The other a black-spotted yellow cat, with one paw on a dead deer-like creature half its size, with long straight horns and white stripes. There were a number of people in the room, but that was all she had time to notice before a sharp-faced woman in blue robe stepped forward, one side of her head shaved, and the remaining hair in a long brown braid that hung in front of her right shoulder. Her blue eyes, full of contempt, could have done for the eagles or the cats.
"You are in the presence of the High Lady Suroth, who leads those who come before and succors the return," she intoned, in that same slurring accent.
Without warning, the hook-nosed officer seized the back of Morgaze's neck and bore her down prostrate beside him.